You know, I have never seen one inmate just walk in here and be unanimously hated by the entire population. I ain't never seen it.
How'd I get so lucky?
You could have robbed banks. You could have sold crack. You could have stole your grandmama's pension. Nobody would have cared. But shaving points off a football game? Man, that's just un-American. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. I'm your curator and one of your hosts, Mr. Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator and the other host, as we delve deeply into the cinematic universe of one Adam Sandler, it's Mr. Sejan Serowick. Sejan.
Hi. Thank you very much, Devin. This is definitely going to be a hard one today as we look at Adam Sandler's classic, The Longest Yard, which takes a hard look at the prison system of America and really the way that it comments on the for-profit systems and the ways in which the prisoners are treated as nothing more than just meat. It's a hard watch, Devin.
Oh, I agree vividly with that statement. The fact that this is the number two highest-rated sports comedy film tells me that your basic American viewer is not looking for the deeper subtext, because to me, The Longest Yard is, as it always has been, a tragedy.
Now, hold on a second.
I wasn't breaking this time.
No, hold on a second. I will give you this. This might be the darkest film in the Happy Madison catalog. Not the darkest film we have seen. I think that's always going to be held by Mixed Nuts, always and forever at this point going forward. But man, this one was... Dev.
Hoof indeed. When's the last time you watched it before we filmed? I just want to know how fresh it is in your mind.
So this isn't one of the regulars for me. I have seen this movie maybe once, and it was legitimately at like a lock-in or some shit. Like, it was like in the background. I didn't go to theaters to see this movie. I was not. However, I will say, this is one of the ones that is often like referenced as one of the quote unquote good ones by, you know. Whenever I say that, I always think of the older folks at church, right? Like the old church moms that we used to all get taken care of as we were growing up, and what they would let us watch and not let us watch when we would go to these things like sleepovers and lock-ins and shit like that. And, you know, I've talked in the past about how some Adam Sandler movies have snuck into that rotation, and this is one of them. This is one of those ones where, like, even the little old ladies would sit around and, like, quote at each other. And, you know, it's a remake of the 1970s classic with Burt Reynolds, featuring Burt Reynolds still in it, right? Like, it does a lot of due diligence to pick up the slack to make up for, hey, sorry, we put Adam Sandler in your Burt Reynolds movie. Like, you know, so I saw it maybe once in its entirety. Since then, I have seen pieces of it on and off at, like, bars and stuff. Like, I can recognize it, like, when I see it in front of me. But there's not really much there in terms of, like, long-lasting love for me for this film.
Yeah, but I wanted to know, I appreciate all of that. That's all very good knowledge to have.
You asked me the last time I saw it.
No, well, you watched it for this show, correct?
Oh, yeah.
I'm asking how far removed
we started.
20 minutes? Yeah,
I literally finished it at 3:30 in the afternoon, and we started recording at 4, so.
That's what I wanted to know. I wanted to know how raw, how fresh the emotional reaction to this film was for you. I have watched
once again. I think we're gonna have to sit here and wait for you to explain to us what the emotional. It's not that there is not emotional stuff that happens in this movie for sure, but I didn't walk away from this movie with any feeling of emptiness.
Oh no, it ends rather happily, but it has moments that for me wrench my emotions each time that they happen. The tragedy thing, that was for the character. That was for stuffy curator, film critic, Devin Decker, who starts every episode of the ASCU. I've just ruined the entire structure of the show. No, I don't think it's a tragedy. I mean, I think there's an interpretation of it as a tragedy, but I think, here's the thing. I do not
I
want
think
to.
it's raw. I think it's real in a way that a lot of his comedies are not often. Like, I think there is a, I think there is a sense of, there's real stakes. Let's put it that way. There is really shit going on in this movie that are honest to God stakes that people face in this country every day, which is not something you can often say about Adam Sandler in his movies, right? Like in these situations.
Yeah.
And I think in that case, it is definitely a standout amongst the Sandler, you know, repertoire that we have already taken in for this show, is that there is something on the line here and there is some real issues being discussed here that often we don't often see Sandler tackling.
Right.
Pardon the pun.
No, that's, it was a good pun. I'm not, I'm allow you to pun when the pun is that good. But it had been 60 years since Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, if we discount the TV show that seems to be lost media by all accounts right now. This is 31 years after The Longest Yard comes out that they are doing a remake. And honestly, come 2036, I don't think we could do another remake of The Longest Yard. I think that unfortunately this particular well has run dry just because of what we now know about the very system that this film is trying to shine a light on.
See, now I disagree. I just think what you get is you get the gritty reboot. And in a lot of ways, this was kind of a gritty reboot of the 1930s one, but even then.
1974. I'm sorry I brought up.
Thank you. No, you said 1930s and it got caught in my head. Yeah. 30 years ago. A lot of numbers, and I hate numbers. That's why I prefer Goldberg's Jersey.
Fair.
You
that's
see
fair.
Him with the big old X,
with the big old X on it.
Everybody else got a number. All right.
I like to think it stands for 10, but it might just be like a new character, like Mega Man X.
he just really loves Mega Man. No, I think that there is definitely a way to do this movie, but it's not going to be this, right? Like I mean, it's going to be more in line with like a, you know, like a sports drama comedy. And we're in the era where people kind of attempt those. I won't say that they're always successful, but we see a lot of swings at that kind of genre defying like sports movie. I could see somebody trying. Now, do I think it will become the second most watched sports movie of all time, like you mentioned with this one? No, I don't think it will ever reach the heights that this one does. Like I don't think that it's going to be it will be a project, but I don't think that there's any reason why we won't see a remake of this in within 10 years. I mean, the thing is like the story at its heart is one that we see over and over and over again, right? I mean, we see a sports comedy where we have a guy in a weird situation and he has to overcome by learning not just about the sport, but about himself, right? Like we saw that from Adam Sandler already. That's basically Happy Gilmore at its heart, right? Like there's
kind of
there's,
the water boy. It's kind, right. I mean, it's every sports comedy that he's a part of, even Hustle.
I mean, the idea of a sports comedy taking place in a prison being something we won't ever see again is ridiculous. Cause I mean, like this isn't even the only one that does this, like, right? There's like there's an entire franchise in British film with Tony there I can't think of the soccer player's name, but the guy that is in all the Guy Ritchie films and like Lock, Stock and
I can't think. He played the chameleon in not chameleon, whatever, the lizard in The Cape. I can't think of his name either. I mean, but that's a remake of this.
Oh,
it's called
Tony is the movie.
Mean Machine. It's a remake,
right,
of The Longest Yard. It's a British
exactly.
remake. So
as a point to your point about it, about not being able to remake The Longest Yard, there is literally Green Machine, and that actually has at least two sequels. I just don't think Bullet Two Tony's in either of them. But
oh, I wasn't aware of that. I knew about the Mean Machine film that came out in 2001 that is soccer, you know, international football in a prison. But I didn't realize that going forward. But I mean, I this is a difficult one for me to talk about because a lot of the central feelings I have about it are really wrapped up in my Something New, Something Old, Something Borrowed, and Something Blue. So I just want to leave that off. But I guess we've been talking for 10 minutes. We haven't really told these people who we are, why we're here. I mean, it's like our 28th episode, so I hope that people understand who we are and why we're here. But I mean, the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we are trying to take all of the films that Adam Sandler has made and see if there is an existing cohesive continuity in which they all take place. Sijin and I do another podcast called The Say Report, which is a show about everything. This is the one that's focused in on the one singular topic, and that topic just happens to be the films of Adam Sandler. And specifically, this is the second episode of season 5 of the ASCU, where we are focusing on the remakes, the reboots, and the redos. And as this is a remake of another film, it kind of fit perfect into that number 2 slot. Also, it's February, and if you're listening to this the day that it dropped, February 10th, there's a pretty big game coming up in 2 days.
Yeah, there's a moderately sized game coming up in 2 days.
I think legally we have to call it the big game, though. I think that's how we refer to it. I have no feelings towards the Superb Owl this year. I will be the first to say that.
I think we've had this conversation before, especially on the Say Report itself on Mainline Show. But like, we're staring down the barrel of a pretty mediocre Super Bowl. Like, I understand that there are two teams that are there that fought to get there, but every Super Bowl, comes a moment where the nation has to decide, is this the one where we all pick a side, or is this the one where we let them just do their thing and we all just enjoy the game? And this is definitely the latter, right? I don't hear the people. I honestly, the way people have been talking out here about the Super Bowl, I thought it was last weekend. Like, it took me a second to be like, I can't believe I didn't sit down for 2 seconds and watch the game. And then I looked it up and I was like, oh, that's because it hasn't aired yet.
No, they're probably talking about the Pro Bowl, which was excellent because it was Manning versus Manning.
Grocery stores are already starting to shrink their Super Bowl sections for other stuff, for Valentine's Day and shit like that. Like it's such a lost cause out here. So this is kind of my Super Bowl.
Yeah, exactly. The Mean Machine versus the Guardsmen, which is, I'm pretty sure, the name of the other team. The Pros versus the Cons. If I want to quote the sign outside of the high school where they're playing.
I don't know what makes them the Pros, but yeah.
Well, I think we'll get there. We will get there, I promise that. But yeah, so we're looking at reboots, and as a reboot of a football movie, you almost have to do it in February. I think that there might be a law that we're unaware of. But yeah, so this is it. This is kind of my big game, too. I have no feelings towards either of the teams that are in the Super Bowl, and I mean, it's weird to think I'm probably not going to watch, but honestly, I'm probably not going to watch. And if you want to hear more talk about that, then tune into the Say Report that's going to be dropping this next Monday. I bet this is going to be a topic. I'm in pretty close with the guy who comes up with the topics, and he's assured me this is going to be covered. For now, though...
Topics? What? You all are getting topics?
For now, though, The Longest Yard. This is a remake, as we said, 1974 film with Burt Reynolds. And Sijin told his whole story about where he saw it before he watched it for the show. This is one of my 10 lost Sandler films. This is one of the 10 films that I just never saw before doing this show. And I actually counted them up and figured out what they were. For this episode specifically, because this is one where I talk to my parents about it, and they're like, how have you never seen The Longest Yard? And I'm like, well, I mean, I've seen the Burt Reynolds one. They're like, no, how did you not see the Adam Sandler one? And I'm like, I don't know, I've just never seen it. Apparently, they're quite big fans of it.
Yeah, that seems to be the case in a lot of ways with this particular movie. Is it kind of falls right into that category when we were at the right age where, like, it just, we didn't have to see it. We were too cool for school. I don't know why, but like, we just didn't see it. But it seems like everybody else in the world did, and everybody else in the world is like, oh yeah, The Longest Yard's like the good one. It's like, oh, okay.
I mean, this past weekend, probably to get ready for the big game coming up in a week, and the fact that the Pro Bowl was going on, Comedy Central played it like 4 times.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's cool. And then on another channel was Mr. Deeds. And at that point, I felt like maybe we're affecting TV with our topics. But that's just egotism talking. But yeah, so this is not one that I had any particular affinity for. And I've been talking like tragic and the stuff like that, but there's moments that like rip my heart out of my chest. And the moment at the end of this film is like really tense the first time. Like, Uncut Gems does not own the sole rights to a tense moment in an Adam Sandler film. It just owns the rights to the longest tense moment in an Adam Sandler film. And like, yeah, there one way that I think you could remake this movie again. I'll save it for later, but ask me that. You'll know the time to ask me, Seijin.
But wasn't there an HBO show not 2 years ago with The Rock coaching a prison football team?
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, Gridiron. I'm pretty sure it was called Gridiron. Like,
yeah, I thought Gridiron was a movie.
Oh, even better.
That's a movie, and that came out before this, didn't it? I thought that was a 2000.
No, it came out after this.
Okay.
But there, yeah, no, I'm thinking Gridiron Gang is definitely a movie that came out in 2006, but that's not what I'm thinking of. Keep talking. I'm going to research this.
Look,
because
up...
I just remembered that there was like a whole like prison football, like TV show within the last five years.
But what I'm specifically talking about is remaking the story of The Longest Yard. That's the big thing to me. I feel like this is the moment in time where it was able to get remade in the way that it was remade, and we might never see it again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, what about it says that? Because, again, I don't necessarily agree. So I'm curious to know why you feel...
All right, so we're just going to go early. We're going to break tradition and everything. We're going to go into something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue, which will be really fun because the people don't know how the show works yet. I haven't told them about the movie. Should I read my synopsis? I don't want to burn that. Like, that's the problem. Yeah. And my stuff really feeds into the reasoning why.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm curious to hear, but you've teased for later. Let's stick to the formula and do it right. What's next?
All
right.
Well, before you were going to look up the Rock show, I was going to ask you for some facts and figures.
Yeah, well, I mean, those I just have in front of me.
Yeah, well, but that's what I was that's what I was working the segue up to. So.
Yeah, so The Longest Yard, sorry, your segue went off a cliff, and I didn't see it, so...
It's okay. It landed in whatever prison The Rock was teaching football in? I don't know this show that you're talking about. I know Ballers with The Rock. I didn't know he had something else with
HBO. Maybe I'm mixing up. Maybe I'm combining Gridiron Gang and Ballers. I don't know. I gotta keep looking.
Okay.
So The Longest Yard comes out 2005. It comes out in May of that year, and it hits number one the first weekend it comes out. I mean, this is a successful film. There's no beating around the bush. It's a, you know, it's a budget of $80 million, $82 million, I think is the specific number that I have written here. It ends up making 160 domestic. It ends up making another 40 worldwide. I mean, it's a $200 million success. Like, this is a successful film. The coolest thing about it, I think the greatest claim to fame it has in terms of box office, is it comes out the week after Revenge of the Sith and pretty much immediately dethrones Revenge of the Sith as the top movie. Like, you know, episode 3 comes out, gets on a Wednesday, gets like a couple of days worth of being number one. Everybody's talking about their feelings about it. We all have our feelings about Revenge of the Sith. And very next week, Longest Yard comes out and dethrones it immediately. So.
And let me tell you, I very rarely see Revenge of the Sith on cable. Longest Yard is on there every few weeks. It's not reached step-brotherly levels where it's on somewhere at any given time. Or Twister. I think Twister is the other one that people talk about as a movie that's on at any given time if you flip through the channels. But it's pretty close. In terms of like Adam Sandler films that are readily available, I feel like The Longest Yard is the number one film. And I understand why, too, after watching it. Because it appeals to pretty much everything American. Like, that speech we took in the morning, like, point shaving, un-American. The Longest Yard, though, hyper-American. It's, like, I mean, which is not necessarily the flex it sounded like in my head when you think about the fact that it's about the prison system and how it takes advantage of the people who are incarcerated there. And, yeah.
Yes. It's directed by Peter Siegel, who we've seen, who just gotten done directing 50 First Dates and then rolls right into this. They seem to do like three movies with every director that they work with, Happy Madison. And so this is number two, I think we've seen. I imagine eventually we will see the third, Anger Management, eventually, right?
Yeah, eventually. I think we'll see it third, three, three. I'll stop right now. It's
but I think the other big thing, the other important thing to note about this movie is that in terms of like remakes and recreations and things like that, it's relatively faithful. And so to that point, like, this is Adam Sandler doing The Longest Yard, right? Like, this is not an Adam Sandler movie that happens to have this veneer of, hey, we took the same plot. Like, they are making that film again.
This is not Mr. Deeds. In terms of remakes,
right.
this is not, let's reimagine it if it were happening in modern times. This is pretty much, let's make The Longest Yard, except instead of 1974, it's 2005.
Yeah, and you know, and to that point, there's not a lot of Happy Madison silliness, like in like there's not a bunch of dumb sound effects, right? Like, there's not a bunch of weird moments where like people, where bodies are behaving in ways that bodies don't behave, right? Like, the most that I think you can get in that regard is the ways that people get hit in this movie and then the way they get back up. But like, it's not Bobby Boucher levels of violence where people are like flying across the field, right? There's a groundedness to this film, and I think that comes from them trying to stay so faithful to the original concept, not necessarily the original movie beat for beat, because there is definitely a different flow to this movie, right? Part of that is just because we make movies differently, though, right? But I mean, down to getting guys like Burt Reynolds to be in this movie again, right? Like, Burt Reynolds comes back and plays the older character, but that character was present both. Paul Crewe is definitely who Burt Reynolds plays in the original movie, but the character that he plays in the remake is also one that was in the original movie. He just basically moves up a step. So it's really interesting to see this group really trying to, you know, be respectful, I guess, of this film that they clearly had a lot of love for when they were making this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I have to imagine that Adam Sandler saw this at age 7. He was 7 years old when it came out, and there's no way. Burt Reynolds was such a force in America in the 70s.
In the 70s, making, I mean, to the point that he ends up almost winning an Oscar. He didn't end up winning for Boogie Nights, right? But he almost ends up winning an Oscar for basically, like, enveloping the 70s in Boogie Nights in the early 90s. When he shows up, he pretty much owns the 70s, because that is what everybody thinks of when they think of Burt Reynolds, you know?
He is undeniably on the Mount Rushmore of the 70s.
Yeah.
Almost ironically, alongside Star Wars.
His mustache and his chest hair are kind of specifically what are up there.
Which is why The Longest Yard in the original film, right? And I'm not going to talk about the original film too much, but when they shave his mustache off, and I had to get used to a mustacheless Burt Reynolds, that took some time for me, because that's what I knew him as. He's not clean shaven.
Yeah, so I mean, this is kind of in the height of Sandler's, you know, big. Basically, he can do no wrong at this moment. As I said, he had just come off of 51st Dates with Peter Siegel, and that did pretty gangbusters. And now here we are with this, like, Longest Yard, and this does awesome. I think the only other big thing worth mentioning at this point is really that in addition to Happy Madison producing this, this has one of the largest kind of producing teams out of all of the movies that we've seen. And MTV is up in the mix, and this is really kind of the only time that Sandler really works with them, which I think is interesting considering who he was in the 90s and stuff. You would think that MTV would have like jumped on the bandwagon somewhere along the line with him, even just for a couple of movies, but this is the only time that we see MTV Productions like involved in a Sandler joint. But I think part of that is also from the other side, is because this is such a big movie, there's a lot of big names in this movie that I'm sure we will talk about as we go through some stuff, but MTV brings a lot of heft in that regard, in terms of casting, and so the large production team in general, the fact that one of those production teams is made up of MTV, is like, watching the movie totally makes sense. Like, I just can't believe it's the only time we've ever seen it.
I guess the problem is watching it in 2023, where everything has sort of congealed together into 5 different cheeses on the buffet. And, you know, MTV used to be its own cheese, but now it's just melted into Paramount. To me, I see that and I'm like, oh, of course, Paramount was part of it. And then they put it out under the MTV logo because that's what would be most profitable for them. but I don't know.
Paramount's logo is also on it, right?
And that's,
like, it's not,
yeah,
and it's not out under, like, it's not called an MTV film. Like, MTV's not top line billed for it, right? I actually was surprised when I saw that MTV Films was even involved in it, and then, like, it just went away. It's just that when I looked back at the cast, I was like, oh, this is why you get somebody like the MTV casting department involved in this shit, right? It's because when half of your cast is going to be made up of WWE stars, like, yeah, this is, yeah. And we act like this is a new thing, that everything is owned by five companies, but I will point out that they've always been Viacom. They've always,
yeah, well, MTV's, I didn't know, I didn't Viacom, know Paramount, when, like, Viacom and Paramount became one thing. I didn't want to assume that it was something that was active in 2005, because I know that Viacom was part of a big, like, it was absorbed at some point. I just don't know if this is at the point when it was.
Viacom owned MTV and Nickelodeon, for people that are keeping track. Like, Viacom was in charge of all of that stuff. They were at some point absorbed by Columbia, Paramount, and all of that. Then they,
well, Columbia is Sony, so
Time Warner.
Yeah,
but it all comes down to AT&T. Like, that's the thing, is even if you follow Sony's money all the way back, like there's sections that are co-owned, and it's always just been two or three companies that have all just been glad-handing each other for years. I mean, really, you want to talk about it, it all comes back to Yum Brands, but we're not here to talk about Sarah Port. We're here to talk about
No. All right, but I know that Viacom was its own thing, at least in 2011, because it was Viacom who bought Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from Peter Eastman. I mean, from Peter Laird. I can't believe I just did that. So Paramount and MTV are not the same thing at this point. And that's the thing that I had to keep reminding myself when
Viacom CBS was created in 2019.
Okay, perfect. So
before that, they were owned by Paramount. They were bought by Paramount in, I'm not seeing a date on that.
Like, it sounds like 2019. That makes sense to me. If that's when that would happen.
No, they were renamed that in 2019.
Okay, gotcha.
So they were already owned. They solidified that they were going to be renamed that. I have always known Viacom as a Paramount property. Like,
okay, so then maybe I'm.
I was not aware that they were not the same thing.
I guess maybe they were, but we didn't have the transparency, because it was one of those situations.
I thought they were.
Yeah, but that's. I just didn't want to assume it. Like, it felt like it was me supplanting my knowledge of the corporations from 2023 onto this film. And, like, the Paramount of it all makes sense, because the original movie is a Paramount film. And the reason they have to play ball with Columbia Pictures, a Sony Pictures corporation, is because of Adam Sandler. Because he is so tightly tied to them in 2005. And then going forward, we see that constantly, right? That if you want Adam Sandler, Columbia is going to get in the mix. So first of all, this movie starts and you see Paramount and Columbia Pictures.
So Viacom joined contract with CBS in 1985.
Okay. And then CBS has been owned by Paramount since forever, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Viacom Paramount on contract with CBS Paramount acquires MTV 1985.
Okay. Cool. Cool. Yeah. That's excellent to know. So then that's even crazier. Because that is, I would have never thought back that far. I thought it was something more recent because of the way that we referred to them. You never hear Viacom anymore. Viacom is one of those things that, like, has just kind of slowly faded into the background in terms of, like, company names you hear. And that's all because of the streaming wars. And I know this is more Stay Report stuff, and I'm sorry for that, but it is one of those situations where I see Paramount, I see Columbia, I see MTV, and I'm like, well, that checks out. Everything there checks out for me. Like,
yeah, I mean, because they own the original movie and all that. But I think that the reason that MTV specifically is present is definitely when it comes to the casting and the soundtrack. I mean, it's the stuff that MTV excels at.
Yeah.
It's the reason why MTV, you see MTV movies on so many movies that, like, you're just like, wait a minute, this is an MTV film? Like, and it's because MTV's casting department, like their not creation department, production department, that's what I was looking for, their production side of things is pretty fucking stellar. Like, they can put a movie together. I'm not going to say that they're going to be, like, award-winning films, but they know what audiences want to see. Part of that is because they are connected to television in such a way that, like, you know, they know what people are watching. They've never been afraid to just put up something, even if everybody else in the world hates it. I mean, we recently talked about MTV on Say Report about how they've let 60% of their programming become fucking ridiculous, right? But that's because that's what people watch. And guarantee you, I could find two bars right now that I could go to that I know probably have ridiculous playing on a TV in a bar somewhere.
Is it ridiculous, right? Or ridiculousness?
It might be ridiculousness. I don't know. Okay. I watch that show.
I don't either. That's why
bars. That's the most
I thought it was. I just thought it. Like ridiculous is like ridiculousness sounds like something you can trademark. Ridiculous, like that feels like they're out
well,
there with pants.
I think it's ridiculous, first of all, because it's Rydick there. What is his name? Yeah, Rydick. I don't know, but that's. Yeah, so when I see that MTV is involved in this movie with him and it's the only time they've ever worked together, it just raised my eyebrows because I can totally see the influence of MTV on this film. I just can't believe that this is the only time he's ever felt the pull to work with him, because again, they're everywhere.
But I think that might come down to him being so tied to Columbia. This is really his only time that he's ever worked with Paramount. And if he's not working with Paramount, then he's not going to have the access to MTV.
I know. It's just that we can't talk about these companies like they're fucking fortresses that never open their doors to one another. They always work together. And I think that's a real real problem nowadays, the ways people talk about how everybody's buying everything and everything's owned by one company and all of this stuff is a nonsense conversation, because it's always been that way. And what'll happen is that a small independent company will work its way up and it'll become the new other thing. And then that'll get absorbed too. Or it might get big enough to do some absorbing of its own. Like the day will come where we will finally hear about somebody buying something from Disney and it's going to blow everybody's mind.
Yeah. No. And that's, I guess what I'm saying is like 2005, this sort of collaboration makes sense. I don't view them as fiefdoms. I know that they have always worked together, but current year 2023, we're seeing a lot less of that as they all start to focus on their own streaming services and they don't want to play ball with one another. But I think that's what we're going to see as they have to open themselves up, because just focusing on their own little lands, they realized, oh, we don't have enough grain, right? We need to go to the place that has the surplus of grain and work out deals with them.
Like, I mean, it starts to, I mean, at some point they start getting so, like, insular that it just becomes the studio system again.
Yeah.
Where Adam Sandler is just making movies just for Sony and not allowed to make movies for other companies. And if he dare tries, they're going to ruin him, right? Like, I'm not saying that's what happened or how he was treated. I'm just pointing out that in the old studio systems,
that's how it would have happened. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, and who knows if that, I don't think we'll get there. I think they all, the bubble kind of burst on all of them. So now they realize that they can't do that, but we'll see where things go. But
I don't know. Netflix owns Sandler pretty whole hog in a lot of ways with what he's doing, and he seems pretty happy doing that. You know, I will believe that that is not what's going on once he makes a movie not for Netflix.
Okay, but he's done that, hasn't he? Like the Hotel Transylvania stuff isn't for Netflix. That's
he's
all owned by Sony.
One.
That's
Remember,
true.
He was not allowed to be in the last one because of his Netflix deal. The only one made since his Netflix deal.
No, Hotel Transylvania 2 was made since his Netflix deal. But maybe in production prior to the deal. So anything, that's a good point. This is a lot of stuff talking about the corporate gross for profit parts of entertainment. And honestly, if we were ever going to do that in an episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, I feel like The Longest Yard would be the time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, he's at the top of his game, and he's able to pull these companies together to remake this movie, and it's clearly a choice on his part that this is the movie he wants to make. I do not feel like somebody held his hand to the fire to remake The Longest Yard. And I mean, like, throughout the entire film, you get this feeling that this is a character he cares about, this is a story he cares about, there is a lot of, and that's why I say that this is kind of one of the most Adam Sandler movies we've gotten to watch. There's a lot of just raw Adam Sandler, like, in this film, you know. I mean, to that point that Paul Crewe is, I like Paul as a character, but I wouldn't say he's much of a character. He feels like he's just Adam Sandler playing football with his friends. There's so much Adam Sandler in this football movie that we don't even get to see good football played in this movie until a basketball game is played.
That's a good point. Also, I mean, the way that it's narratively structured, but I understand where you're coming from with that. You bring up a good point.
We don't even get to see clips of good football. We don't get to see any of him on the field beforehand. We don't get to see shit. We see a couple of moments of bad football being played by the other prisoners, and then he goes out to recruit, and then he plays a full-on basketball game, with which that is the best sports that we see up to this point.
Yeah, that basketball game, that's something that's not in the original. Just point that out. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I enjoy this film a lot, but you bring up some really good points. Yeah, I guess that's good. I like that. And I like to thank you for confirming the knowledge that Paramount and MTV at this point were in there. Because I felt very much like you need to shut off your modern gaze for this film. But no, they did it. They knew what they were doing when they farmed it out to MTV as one of their production studios.
Yeah, well, one of like 6 or 7 for this one, which is also something that doesn't usually happen.
Yeah.
Like Happy Madison, it's not that he never works with other production companies. There's usually 2 or 3 up there, right, besides mm-hmm. Happy Madison. But this one is like a good like half a dozen.
It's at least and 5 that I could name yeah. right now. It's Paramount, yeah, right. Columbia, MTV Films, Happy Madison, and then Callahan Filmworks.
Callahan, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, because it's a Peter Siegel film. So,
right.
Yeah, like it's wild. They don't make them like this anymore. And that's kind of my big thesis watching this film. And watching this film as a remake from 18 years ago. Which is also something that's going to become important. But before that, is this synopsis time? It feels like it's synopsis time. Ba-ba-ba-bum! That's not in the synopsis. It was just fun to say.
I think if you do that again, we might get sued.
Oh, yeah. If I do one more note, we'll get sued. Like, I can do what I just did. And we're, like, on the cusp of okay. Oh, God. Now all I want to do is that. Paul Wrecking Crew, former NFL MVP and only person ever indicted on federal racketeering charges for point shaving in a professional football game, is currently serving 5 years probation for his crime. Unfortunately, after a drunken bender ends with him pursued by police in his girlfriend's stolen Bentley, his prohibition is revoked and he'll be serving the remaining 3 years of his sentence in prison. Despite committing his crime while playing for Pittsburgh and now living in Los Angeles, Crew winds up being sent to Allenville Federal Penitentiary in Texas at the behest of Warden Rudolph Hazen, a man with gubernatorial aspirations and a deep love for the game of football. Seems Allenville has quite a talented Garg League football team, but it's been 5 years since they won a championship, so when presented the opportunity to bring an actual, factual professional football player on as a consultant and restore them to their former glory, Hazen leapt at the chance. Naturally, Paul has no interest in contributing to the sport that left him behind and declines the warden's offer, prompting Hazen to assert his dominance over Paul by putting him in the hot box and hopefully forcing him to change his mind. After a week in the oven, Paul agrees to take a look at the team and determines that what they need is a tune-up game, or opportunity to beat the living shit out of a weaker squad to help bolster their confidence. Hazen loves the idea and declares that Paul will be responsible for recruiting, training, and acting as quarterback to a team of convicts for a game to be held in 4 weeks. When Paul protests, saying all he wants to do is serve out his sentence and get out of there, Hazen reminds him that as he is the one in charge, should Paul choose not to comply with his order, as warden, he could very easily increase the length of his incarceration. Left without options, Paul teams up with 2 of his fellow inmates. Caretaker, who can get you whatever you might need on the inside, will be team manager, while Nate Scarborough, former Heisman Trophy winner for Oklahoma State, acts as coach. Together, the 3 find the meanest players available and convince them to play with the promise of payback against the guards for their constant abuses of power. Soon the guards grow nervous that the inmates might actually be able to defeat them and employ the services of a convict named Unger to take care of the problem in a way only a criminal can. Unger's solution is to leave a bomb in Crew's cell to eliminate him as a threat, but Caretaker accidentally sets it off while dropping off a gift and dies as a result. Now with his first friend in years gone, and the warden promising a lifetime sentence should he fail to throw the game, Paul Motley Crew must decide between letting down the found family of his team and freedom.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So
I'm trying not to cry. The death of Caretaker hits me so fucking hard. I don't
I mean,
know.
it's one of the darkest moments I think that we've seen, and again, in a very specifically in a Happy Madison produced film. I mean, like, it almost feels like it comes out of nowhere for what the rest of this movie is. And it's not that this movie does not kind of delve into like that idea, right? Like, these are prisoners, and these are not all like good people, and they do their best to walk that line between reminding you that these guys are convicts while also trying to make them the heroes of their film, right? And so there is like that fine line that they walk, and I don't know if they always succeed in that regard. What they do succeed in is making sure that you hate the guards more than you hate the inmates. That much you definitely feel, right? So yeah, this really dark moment where this character that we've been with this whole time, this character played by Chris Rock, and like basically the second lead of this film up until this point, like is just blown up, immolated even, and
He
like
is fully immolated, and it
they
is.
watch him burn, like through, like they show like the fire like reflecting on Adam Sandler's face. It is a really upsetting moment in this movie.
And they do this great thing. This is praise, high praise for The Longest Yard. In a moment that makes me scratch my head, made me scratch my head that first time, and continues to make me scratch. I've watched it 3 times this week alone. For the first time I've ever seen this movie, I sat through it 3 times. And when it goes to caretaker walking into the prison, and then the shot through the internals of the clock into the lockdown area of the penitentiary,
I don't know what that is. It
this is the craziest thing ever, because it totally feels like, oh, check it out, it's 2005. Look what we can do with computers. But it really does this great job to kind of like leave you wobbly legged, like you're kind of thrown off. So then you go back into it and you're just like, oh, okay, let's get back to it. And because you're already off balance, when they punch you in the gut with what happens to Caretaker, like you feel it through every nerve ending in your body. Like they set you up for this to be like, this dude just fucking died. And also, like the other thought that's rolling around in your head is, and the person who was supposed to die was Adam Sandler. Like
Yeah.
it's heavy moments. Like
Yeah,
just
I mean it's wild that it happens, to be entirely honest, because like it's one of the only moments in the movie to me that feels like they do it because they're supposed to, not because they wanted to, as filmmakers, right? Like there's a feeling to that beat that feels different than anything else in the movie. And part of that is because it's so dark. It's just hard to wrap your head around that moment being wrapped up in the rest of this film sometimes.
And here's
I don't know if they fully earn it, I guess is what I'm saying. I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
So it's really strange. And then we got to go into New Old Borrowed Blue, because I want to just get them out there, and then I really want to delve into this, especially as you're talking about what feels beholden to the original and that being the motivation behind it. But another crazy thing that like is just early 2000s filmmaking, it's something that we decided to do again in the 2000s, is that sacrificial lamb trope. That fact that like somebody's going to die so that you understand the stakes of it. And
Right.
like to really swing it around, it feels like it's kind of entertainment's reaction to what happened on September 11th, 2001, is this realization that like as good as things are, this is always out there waiting in the weeds, like something terrible could happen. And the one that I specifically think of is like Step Up. Like a character dies in the movie Step Up. The first
Yeah, no,
Step Up.
it's the trope is the shit just got real trope.
Yeah.
Like it's that moment where this very fun time that you've been having, whether it's a family movie, a kids movie, a comedy, there's a moment where, as you said, the stakes need to really kind of be set, and that is definitely what's going on here. It's the shit just got real moment.
Yeah, and it is, and but I wholeheartedly agree with you that in a weird way, it's not earned, but it's not earned twofold. It's not earned based on the metric that we're measuring on in the 70s, when this happens in the original film. And it's not earned based on that metric of what films were in the 2000s. It's one of those things, like, the first time I watched Step Up with my family, my mother paused it and was like, is Skinny gonna die? And I'm like, you're gonna have to keep watching the movie. Spoilers for Step Up. And also, other spoilers for Step Up, none of the other ones have a death like that. Like, it is very much like...
I mean, this is such a trope, though, that they end up making fun of it in Broken Lizard's... not Beer League. What's the name of that one?
Beer Fest.
Where they do the... Beer Fest, thank you.
Yeah.
Where they make fun of that, where shit gets real and one of them gets murdered and then is immediately replaced by his twin brother, who's...
Yeah.
Who's like, don't treat me any differently than you would have treated him.
Yeah, and that's 2006 Beer Fest. Right. So it's like, we had kind of gotten to this point, like, this is... If I had to give The Longest Yard just more accolades, and I will throw accolades at this movie, I cannot believe this is a film that prior to 3 days ago, I had zero knowledge of. That boggles my mind, that I did not realize how good Adam Sandler's version of The Longest Yard is. Like, it truly is quite an enjoyable film. Even with this moment that, like, I'm focusing on, and like it weirdly feels unearned and stuff like that. But throughout my notes, I have all these little jots of this. Where did this come from? Where is this coming from? Like, I don't know. It's a lot of thoughts, but let's stop that and let's do something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue, so I can introduce my thing. And then we can really, really delve into this. So Something New, Something Old, Something Borrowed Blue is a segment on the show where we talk about something that would be new to the Adam Sandler cinematic universe if there is a shared cinematic universe. Something old, so something we've already seen. Something borrowed from outside of the borders of the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films. And something blue, the definition of which is always hotly contested between Seijin and I. So Seijin...
You want to fight about it?
You want to fight about it?
Are you asking that I go first?
No, I'll go first.
Yeah.
And then you can go first on the second two, and then I'll go first on the last one. I like how we do this. So for me, and this took a lot of work on my part to confirm that this is true, because we haven't gone through the cinematic universe in proper order, so I had to check against all the movies. This is the first time that the WWE really comes to play in the cinematic universe.
Mm-hmm.
Because we saw the Big Show as Captain Insano in The Waterboy, but that was still when he was with WCW. So that was before he had joined WWE to become the Big Show in 1999. So technically, we hadn't seen it. We'd seen wrestling before, but WWE, Worldwide Wrestling Entertainment, coming to play ball with Adam Sandler feels like a huge win for both sides.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just tell you right now, that was my borrowed, is he basically borrowed the entire mid-2000s WWE lineup for this movie, and it's like all over this film.
Yeah, it is crazy. While Dwayne Johnson is being the Scorpion King in The Mummy Returns, you have Bill Goldberg, you have Kevin Nash, you have Stone Cold Steve Austin, you have the great Kali coming in and just acting their asses off and having a ball. Like, it seems like, in a weird way, their presence and all of the wrestling that is present in this film kind of makes it feel like a direct sequel, like spiritual sequel to The Waterboy, despite the fact that, no, we don't want you to think that at all. We don't think what you just said, Devin, but like, a lot of the production work, I get how you got there. I understand it. There are so many drop kicks on the field, Seijin. It's a little crazy.
I don't think they were playing very fair in this game, I'll be honest.
Which team?
Well, both.
It was a tune-up game. It was a tune-up game. So different rules apply.
Yeah, I know. Excellent, man. Yeah, no,
And
the
we're going
ways
to
in
see
which
more
they.
WWE going forward in films that we haven't yet seen. So.
Yeah, the ways in which this dives into the WWE lineup, and what's important about guys like the great Khali and even Bob Sapp is even a wrestler at this time, is that these guys are not WWE guys. They were brought over by the WWE to fight as like special presenters over here, but these are wrestlers from like Japan and India and shit. Like these guys are from all over the world, and so what's going on at this time in wrestling is that it's a lot of consolidation. There's a lot of let's bring in special guests, and then like within the next couple of years, pretty much they are owned by the WWE, right? Like that kind of stuff is happening. Also, the WWE is buying up stuff like WCW and things like that and turning them into what their whole like empire, right? So that's what's going on that side. And then, like, you know, then Adam Sandler makes this movie where he needs a bunch of big dudes that know how to be on camera and take hits. Like, yeah, like they turn to the WWE and they get this whole like just plethora of just amazingly fun actors. Because I mean, and they're all over the place. They're not just the cons. You see them as, you know, you see one or two of them as the guards. You see one just showing up in the background as cheering them on at the football game. Like there's random moments where you see just these big dudes, and it's because they just went whole hog on getting a bunch of wrestlers to just show up in this movie.
I think the really interesting thing is the heels are not the heels. Like Stone Cold Steve Austin, he wasn't a heel. He was like a hero. So for him to be one of the guards is really interesting. Ditto somebody like Kevin Nash. Now, Kevin Nash for me is always the super shredder. But like that was the whole thing, is that he was going against character when he was the super shredder. So like it's really interesting because Goldberg was like a bastard. So then for him to be one of the con good guys, like it's really interesting how because you're bringing in these people who have almost established storylines like globally, right, to like a huge part of the collective consciousness, it's evidence of Adam Sandler having his finger on the pulse, and it is understanding the right way to mess with people's expectations via cinema.
Well, and he has access to a bunch of these guys because WWE is owned by Viacom, so he also, that's the other reason why he has access suddenly to a bunch of these guys, and we don't necessarily see them to like in this amount before or going forward. Like yeah, they definitely start popping up as wrestling contracts start to get a little bit looser. I mean, I think they are still pretty much indentured servants to fucking Vince McMahon, but that's a whole other conversation. But the idea being that as wrestling contracts have really loosened up over the last couple of decades because they realized, hey, getting these guys into a movie or two is really helpful on both ends, like, we see more and more of them show up in these movies. But up until this point, I think the only reason that we don't see more of them up until this point is because, as you pointed out before, like, they are under a different umbrella than Sandler is. He just doesn't have access to them in terms of getting them into a film.
Yeah, that's a good point. So is that your new, the Viacom of it all, or do you have a different
no
new?
No, my new is Chris Rock. This is the first Chris Rock appearance, and it's a hell of a one. It's the first time in the timeline chronologically, and the first one I think we've seen, right? Have we seen Chris Rock yet?
So he shows up in Zohan. He's the cab driver in Zohan. It
that's
is a
right.
blink and you miss it moment.
You're right,
I is like, the only reason why Chris Rock isn't my new, but I will say, in my packet, bringing it to this discussion, I was prepared to make the argument for, like, this is the first real Chris Rock role.
No, and I will say that, like, to me, it's more important that chronologically, this is the first time Chris Rock works with him, and I think that's important to point out because it's such a meaty role. I mean, he plays caretaker, he has the death scene, he like, there's so much that he gets to do in this movie that Chris Rock, like, when... Chris Rock doesn't take a movie lightly. Like I don't know many movies I have seen him be in where he's a blink and you miss it. Like Zohan is such a rare exception to that because he is such a fucking force. I mean, like maybe like Pootie Tang where he played, but even then he shows up a lot. He plays the DJ.
He's
in
it more than Pootie Tang. And granted, that's because Pootie Tang. That's how he talks. Like yeah, you need someone who's willing to talk. And at the time, Chris Rock is huge. And is Chris Rock, like, is he a part of the MTV thing? Because when I think MTV in the 2000s, I think Chris Rock.
I mean, probably. In terms of, I think it's more of him being under Paramount, but MTV definitely being where he's finding himself more comfortable. But I mean, like, One of his first movies of all times is CB4, and he fucking owns that movie. So he's like Sandler. He has a couple of small roles here or there, but generally, if Chris Rock is in a movie, it's a Chris Rock movie, right? And so to see him kind of in this position where he's second to Adam Sandler, and then on top of that, clearly having such a good time with him that we know that he ends up having a pretty long career working with him afterwards. I mean, Chris Rock is one of the leads in the Grown Ups films. Yeah. Like,
Spoilers for crazy. Going forward, 2023 is kind of the year of Chris Rock on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. Almost named the wrong show there. We're going to see a lot of Chris Rock this year.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited for it.
And so as somebody that does not hold this movie up with any nostalgic love, just like, you know, like, clearly I enjoy this film. I think we've all realized by now, but like, it's not one that I go to sleep thinking about like I do some of the other ones. but the idea being that this is the first time him and Chris Rock work together, and this is the role that Chris Rock gets. I get it. I get why you would want to keep coming back and working with these guys again.
Right. Were they not on SNL at the same time? I feel like there was the briefest bit of crossover.
Probably. I mean, yeah, in that mid-90s.
Yeah, I feel like in the mid-90s they were on that together. So it's also them coming back together after SNL.
It's not like they'd never
like, that was such a huge thing. Like, I don't know. I think they were both on it. I can't think of any, like, popular sketches that they were both in.
So he was on SNL until 93, and Sandler started in 92?
91? I feel... Because he wasn't there. He was there enough to make a mark, but I don't know.
1990.
Yeah.
So
so
he was
there's
there
definitely
for
some crossover.
A couple of years with Chris Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not any of those things where, like, I knew that they worked together in this and was very excited about it. And I know that eventually Adam Sandler plays himself in Chris Rock's top five, which is like a very meaningful movement there. So, like, clearly the two guys have a relationship behind the camera too. So
what's the movie miniseries there that they do about the families and the wedding? Right?
The week of. It's just a movie. Thank Christ.
It's just a movie.
We're not doing the week of in 2023, but I'm not looking forward to when we do eventually do it. but hey, there's a whole episode that just got teased in those few words. Yeah, no, the Chris Rock of it all. You know the really crazy thing about the Chris Rock of it all? Do you know what comes out the same week as The Longest Yard?
For Chris Rock?
Yeah.
In 2005, was that Down to Earth?
It's Madagascar.
Oh, Madagascar. That's right. It comes out the same. Number three. So Chris Rock is in two of the top three movies. And the only reason he's not in the other one is because it's fucking Star Wars.
Yeah, that's true. It is 2003. It's 2005 Star Wars. Let's reiterate. Is the prequel trilogy Star Wars? Because I could see him being in the later trilogy. In fact, I'm a little sad he's not now. But
I'll give you a true new. We need to point out Nick Turturro showing up.
Well, Nick Turturro we've seen before too. Chuck and Larry.
I couldn't find him in any of his.
He's in Chuck and Larry, which is why it's super interesting that like he's the homosexual in this film, like with the camera scene and everything, and then he's so blatantly homophobic. And I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry 2 years later. It's real weird. It's real weird because, like, even the trivia on IMDb for The Longest Yard talks about other movies that Adam Sandler has been in with Nick Turturro's brother, John Turturro. And
right.
I'm like, but we're going to completely ignore the fact that they're both in a movie besides this film.
I wonder if IMDb even has him listed because I swear I was like searching over his stuff, trying to figure out if he was new or not.
Yeah, no, he's in Chuck and Larry. We were having that conversation last January because he's great in Chuck and Larry. It's just the weird thing about Chuck and Larry, if you remember from that episode, is it's kind of all the, like, brothers of his usual people. Cause
isn't there, like, a weird Buscemi in that one?
Yeah,
too?
Buscemi's brother, John Turturro's brother, and then Kevin James's brother are all other firemen on their squad.
I'm just out to find out now if IMDb is dropping a ball. He's in Paul Blart. I forgot about that.
Well, yeah, well, I don't. We're not even at the outer tributaries of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe yet. I'm not. I don't know if I'm ready to brave the Happy Madison belt. I mean, there's some movies I'm excited for, but yeah, like that's a whole other ball game. But yeah, no, Nick Turturro. That was another one where I'm just like, I can't believe I always thought of it as he came in on Chuck and Larry. I didn't know that he had such a prominent role in this one. I was surprised.
Yeah, I can't believe though that we've seen two huge roles from Nick Turturro before we ever saw a big role from Chris Rock. That's all.
I mean, no. I mean, Nick Turturro. You mean in the movies that we've watched so
far?
Yeah,
the movies that we've watched in our repertoire. I can't believe that we somehow got two Nick Turturro roles under our belt before we got to
Chris Rock. To be fair, Chris Rock is in this movie with Nick Turturro.
That's true.
So it's like one and a half.
And a half.
I mean, the crazier thing is that I'm pretty sure we got a Nick Turturro film before a John Turturro film. That's the one that just is like, are we doing this right? But yeah, okay. So then moving into old, what was your old, Steejin?
I'd be remiss if I did not point out Rob Schneider showing up as whoever he is in this movie. Who is he supposed to be? Is he supposed to be the same guy who's now in prison?
I don't know. Like, there's the big scary question of it. Because if it is the same character, first of all, he's had a hard couple of years. So, like, to wind up in Texas in prison from Louisiana. But then he was also, like, he's very much the townie in Little Nicky. Like, he's still credited as the townie. What is he credited as in this? If he's not credited as townie, then it's a different character, also played by Rob Schneider.
Well, so part of it is that we're also getting to the, like, uncredited, like, so he's listed here. Let me see if he's listed with an actual name, you know? Like, he might not even be.
I think he's, like, enthusiastic prisoner or something like that.
Yeah, well, let's do the old control F here.
We're searching for Rob Schneider. What is he today? A county or a carrot?
He does actually have a name. He is called Punky, which does not negate the fact that he could be the townie. He just is given an actual name in the credits here.
Is Punky in quotation marks?
No.
Okay, so then I think it's a different character. Because townie is his other character. But goddamn, Rob Schneider.
He gets two whole lines in this movie.
He does get two whole lines. He gets a group hug in the shower. No? Okay. I misread that one. Oh, Rob Schneider. I should not do the Rob Schneider voice. I feel bad. Also, I wrote your old under my column. So, little swappy arrows. I'll understand it later. Yeah, no, seeing Rob Schneider, I didn't expect it, and that's the craziest thing to me. Like,
it's like the only true Adam Sandler bit in this movie. Like, right, if you were to point out, like, bits that recur that we point to and we say, see, this is definitely a Sandler movie because, like, this bit is happening. And this is the only time that happens, right? There's not a moment where Sandler puts on, like, a funny character. There's not a point where Adam Sandler picks up an instrument of some kind, right? Like, this is the
he
only
He doesn't
true...
speak gibberish in this movie. I just realized that. I can't believe my mother has apparently been watching this movie in secret with my father for years, and yet she's never raved about it being the only time he never speaks gibberish. And there's plenty of moments where he could speak gibberish.
Yeah, no, but he never falls into any of the standard Sandler bits, really, in this film. But this moment occurs just to kind of just remind you, like, hey, this is an Adam Sandler
dream. By the way, Happy Madison threw some money in the pot, guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. I like that one. My old... Courtney Cox is in this fucking movie.
Yeah.
Breasting boobily, I might add, as she's like one of the only females we're going to get to exploit in this film. Not to harsh on your blue, but like that dress she's wearing is something else. And it's like, is it a year after Friends that this is her follow-up to that? I don't, first of all, it was crazy to me because, like, we talked about our whole second season on the show was like the recurring females that Adam Sandler has worked with. And we talked about, you know, Drew Barrymore. We talked about clearly Rachel Green, whose name Jennifer Aniston.
Okay.
As we're sitting on Murder Mystery 2 has a release date. It's March 31st on Netflix. So, like, I'm excited. I don't know. I can't speak for Season, but I'm very excited for more Jennifer Aniston, Adam Sandler, for it to finally be able to fight fairly in the trilogy war against Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, to have even a hope of a chance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. I mean, Blended's coming in from the back with a folding chair and then saying something weird about a mother from her son. So,
well, so you have to remember that part of the, so you're about to talk about how we didn't bring up Courtney Cox being in multiple movies with him.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not...
Yeah, well, you know why we didn't talk about it is because she's not technically credited as in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I say. I feel like I can be forgiven for trying to go through and seeing it. Courtney Cox is uncredited, but as somebody who watched Bedtime Stories last season for the fans, we watched that one for the fans, and thank you, fans, because honestly, I don't know when I would have slotted Bedtime Stories in there, but it is... It was just weird to be like, he has worked with Courtney Cox before? I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea. And for her to be like his weird sugar mama in that scene, and then in the later movie, like his sister. But then also, when you look at like...
It's almost like they're acting, Dennis.
Well, no. The distillation, and the reason why it really is interesting to me, is that The Longest Yard... as you've posited, and I think you're proving that argument very well, is one of the most Adam Sandler films ever made, right? Yeah. If not the most Adam Sandler film ever made. And Courtney Cox is there. Courtney Cox is in that. Bedtime Stories is another film that goes out of its way to try to be the most Adam Sandler film ever.
Yeah, as we pointed out, like almost to a formulaic extent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's Courtney Cox again. So, like, and there are also these big collaborations between Columbia Pictures, Happy Madison, and another studio, Paramount with Longest Yard, Disney with Bedtime Stories. It just, like, it really got my mind clicking. But for her to be somebody that he had worked with before, and again, it's, like, they're on camera together for less than a minute. Like, it is... She plays the dumbest person ever, where he's like, my gift that means I love you is in the closet. And then he locks her in the closet.
Well, I think we're supposed to be given the impression that she's not a good person.
Oh, yeah.
Put it that way.
Well,
yeah.
And they do a much better job there than with Burt Reynolds, like, have sex with the woman at the start of The Longest Yard and then just outright punching her. And I'm just like, oh, am I supposed to not like Burt Reynolds in this movie? I always thought I was supposed to root for him.
It is really interesting. It is really interesting how truly kind of unlikable Paul Crewe is as a person at the beginning of both movies.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he is not good. Like, this is a true redemption movie for this character. You know, I think that's another thing that we could talk about, like, in the idea of new ideas for Sandler, is, like, sometimes your redeemable guy that you play in your movie does not have to necessarily be likable.
This is the only movie that we've watched that I can point to where Adam Sandler is not beloved by all.
Right. Right.
Like,
not
and
just
like
walking into a room and yeah.
And like seriously, unanimously hated by every single inmate for point shaving. And then the movie is all about him slowly building up that cred to be the most beloved guy in the prison. Right. Which usually not a distinction you're aiming for, but it's what he goes for. Yeah, like, that was another one that I toyed with. But then the WWE of it all was just so in my face that it seemed like it. But you're not wrong. It's a very different type of narrative for Adam Sandler. Because, like, generally, even in something like Happy Gilmore, which is, like, class warfare, he's beloved by the lower class.
I mean, the biggest example of this is to the Happy Gilmore point, right? Like, Happy Gilmore, the whole joke in that movie is as big of a dick as he is to everybody. He's beloved by the crowd, right? In The Longest Yard, they show up at the end of this movie, at the second half of this movie, at the football game with the actual crowd there, finally seeing civilians like in front of them, and they
hate him. Like, he is just, because all of the work that we have seen him putting into becoming a better person in the last, like, you know, whatever, how long has it been? 2-3 weeks? Is that
four weeks? He's been in prison yeah. for like 6 weeks total, probably.
Right. And spends 2 weeks, the first 2 weeks in the hot box, right? Yeah. Yeah. And so like, it's like we have kind of started to come around on this guy, but we are instantly reminded that the rest of the world does not give a shit about Paul Crewe when he shows up.
Yeah. Because they don't know. They just think of him as the guy who cheated in American football.
And to that point, I think it's also really interesting that we're not given some heroic reason why he did that, right? Like, he openly just says, like, no, I got in with some bad people and had to throw a game. I did exactly what they accused me of, but they couldn't prove it, so it didn't go anywhere. But, like, I also couldn't argue with anybody that called me out on it, so I just don't do anything anymore. Like, it's why he is in the position he is in the first 5 minutes of this movie. It is like he is locked in a room somewhere, like, while this party's going on in this house that is clearly not even his house, right? It's all Lena, I think, is the character.
I think that is her name, yeah.
But like, it's all her stuff, it's all her house, it's her car, everything. He's just this thing that belongs to her in this house that she keeps upstairs and brings out at parties, and he's sick of it, and he basically throws his what little bit of his life is left away. And then when we're given the opportunity later for any type of redemption in that regard, the movie doesn't take it. Like, to their credit, like, they're like, no, Paul is not a good person.
Yeah, that is.
Or rather, he is a good person, but he doesn't make good decisions, I guess, is really what we're supposed to feel.
Yeah. I have to say, though, up until the point where he admitted that, like, yeah, I fell in with bad people and I did this for that, I did wonder if maybe he was innocent. Like, if it was one of those situations where, like, he just had a bad game and some people had been coercing him and then he was in his head and he played off so it looked like he was point shaving. But then right before he admits it, his ability to throw a game by, like, inches short, yeah, or inches, like, overthrown. Like, there's a moment in this movie that is so, like, we're telling you this guy is fucking great. And it is the basketball game, which I'm excited to talk about a little bit more, but where he's like, he's a natural athlete. He can beat these guys in basketball. And he's like,
yeah, the joke about natural athlete is like, I love the reaction Chris Rock has to that, where it's like, so is Greg Louganis.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah, that natural athlete, they get a lot out of that phrase, but it wasn't until that moment where I'm like, oh yeah, Paul Crewe is a great football player. To have not played for like,
you have to be a good actor to play a bad one, right?
Yeah.
Like, you have to be a really good actor to convincingly play a bad actor on television, right? And it's that same idea. If he truly threw a game to the point, like, so well that they could not even catch him on it, like, he must be really good at when he is actually playing.
Yeah.
It's just, I just can't believe that. I wonder if you're feeling that he might be innocent, and I felt it too. Like, I'm not gonna act like I wasn't also there. Like that idea, that concept that he might have been innocent and we just need to find out what happened, like, is that something that the movie gives us, or is that just something that just Hollywood in general has just bred into us? Like, this is how stories are told. We are eventually going to find out that the game he threw was because there was a dog on the field and he didn't want to hit it, right? Or like, his kid was kidnapped and he didn't, or some bullshit. Like, there's some reason why, right? And then the fact that the movie never gives that caught me off guard, like, really surprised me when they were just like, no, he really did do that and he really does belong in this prison, really. It's just like, oh, all right.
That's, I'm going to use that as my segue into Borrowed, which, yeah, we already touched on yours, which was the WWE, right? Did you have anything else?
But yeah.
All right, cool. I'd like to, well, let's go with yours. No, I'm going to take the segue, and I'm going first. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be an asshole.
Mine is more of an observation than anything. So,
oh, okay.
Fine, whatever. So,
So I struggled with Borrowed because of how much this borrows from the original Longest Yard. And then what I realized is, in terms of how this film is remade, it's very theatrical. It's very much how if you and I were to do a version of Romeo and Juliet, we would get the script for Romeo and Juliet and we might make some tweaks to make it uniquely ours. But at the end of the day, it would still be Shakespeare's words. This is so close to the original Longest Yard that, like, production-wise, it feels like they borrowed from how a theatrical production is revived. Like, this feels like a revival more than a remake in so many ways.
Well, it's an interesting thing in this idea, in this landscape of remakes and reboots, right? Like, first of all, I want to, you know, pull the legs out from any conversation about, like, Hollywood started losing its imagination in the 2000s, because I know that's a common thought, like, everything was a remake, is that, like, some of the first films were retellings of books that were famous and, like, remakes of, like, we got three Frankensteins before we got the Frankenstein, or I think the Frankenstein that we think of as Frankenstein is like, actually the third version of Frankenstein. Yeah.
Ten Commandments being made as many times as it was. Like,
so, like, this is what Hollywood has always done, right? And so it's this idea that it becomes a sliding scale, though, for people where of faithful to unfaithful, that becomes the next step for how we talk about it. And you're right, this is such a faithful remake that we rarely get to see this kind of remake made in Hollywood. Part of that is because a lot of the times the stories they're remaking, they're usually telling years later, and unlike theater, something from like the 1970s probably doesn't have a filmed version that people can reference constantly, right? Whereas The Longest Yard is definitely a film that could still be on TV on Sunday afternoon. You could still go back to the exact thing that they're making. And so there's a higher standard in film because of that on the remake scale, because we can literally put them side by side and say, see, this is what they did do and didn't do, versus the restaging of a show that was 50 years old. Nobody around here saw that damn thing. And if they did, they're going to come with warped memories of what it was. They haven't seen it recently enough to have a clean idea, right? Yeah. So there is a level of care to the remake in this movie that is not often applied.
I mean, it feels like revival is what this feels like. It doesn't feel like a remake. It feels like a revival of the script, down to the fact that here is how this movie could get remade in 2036, right? Applying the same 31-year gap, is Adam Sandler is playing Paul Crewe again. And he comes in the same way Burt Reynolds did, but instead of him being Nick Scarborough this time, it is Paul Crewe, who has still been in prison since he decided not to throw that game, who is willing to say, I've been in this situation, let me see if I can help you with it.
Yeah.
Like, because that's what requels are, the reboot sequel hybrid that has been very, like, in the news. It's sort of the soup du jour in Hollywood. Things like Scream 5 and everything like that. The Jurassic World films, where we're going to bring back these characters you already know. But in 2005, and I think that's one of the other reasons why I'm like, the film could not be remade the way the film is. It would be awesome. I would lose my shit if you and I, in 2036, whatever it is that we're doing, we see a fucking trailer for The Longest Yard and Adam Sandler's playing Nick Scarborough. But I just don't think Hollywood allows that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I don't know if Adam Sandler would be involved if they remade it.
That's the other thing. But it would be very cool, because the idea of seeing Burt Reynolds, who initially plays the Paul Crewe character, then playing the Nick Santoro character, is super cool.
Hulu, like, leaning into doing a Longest Yard remake, and Hulu having the connections it now does through Disney to ESPN, meaning that they can get a bunch of actual football people involved. Like, I could see it happening tomorrow, but...
True. But I wish, and that's the other thing, like, that's why I don't think this movie gets remade the same way. I think that a lot of the stuff that they talk about is a little, I don't think it's a safe bet the same way that it was in 2005. Like, where, like, it's Adam Sandler and they're playing, and it's just The Longest Yard. Everybody loves The Longest Yard, right? It's one of those situations. I mean, it's Albert S. Ruddy. I've never been happier that we watched The Godfather for the Say Report than to learn that Albert S. Ruddy, the guy behind The Godfather getting made, wrote the story and was the reason The Longest Yard got made in 1974.
I'm just like,
that's kismet. That's super cool. Like, we didn't plan that. It's just this really cool thing that happened. But then, like, knowing that guy and knowing everything he did, like, yeah, I'm pretty sure he can write this movie. I'm pretty sure he he understands how the federal penitentiary system works. Just a scotch.
All right, man.
But yeah, it is just the way that it is, and then you say that, does the movie make us feel like he's innocent? They do. Because one of the departures from the original film is that lovely moment shared between him and Caretaker, where Caretaker says, "Why did you do it?" And Burt Reynolds tells him, "For the money. I did it for the fucking money. That's why I did this." And Adam Sandler tells Chris Rock, "Don't you read the news? I'm innocent." And that's a big departure from that moment. And it's so that they can hold it close to their vest and have it be like the Newt Rockne moment where he has to inspire the team and get them on his side again.
Yeah.
But like, it's also like, from everything that we've seen with Caretaker, he's always been honest with him. So a thing that he carries with him, and honestly, this is where like my tragedy view of the film comes from, is a lie. Like, one of the last things he told to his only friend in however many years, perhaps his only friend in his entire life, was a lie. Because he didn't want to lose his friend. And he's always living with that guilt. Sorry.
I guess I was not under the impression that he was lying. I guess I was under the impression that he was being coy or cagey. Because the next moment after that is like they make a comment about like everybody in here. So is everybody like there's a sense in that he's not owning up to it, definitely for sure, and not being open and honest with his friend in that final night before his friend dies the next day. Definitely there with you. I don't think that at any point he acted like he was telling the truth, that Caretaker thought he was telling the truth, or that they agreed with I think it was understood between the two of them that he was not talking about it and that they just didn't talk about it.
Right, I get it. I guess it's more the way that Adam plays the role in that moment. Like, it feels like one of those moments where, like, I'm not saying it anymore, but this is the thing where I'm, like, willing to open up to you. I mean, like, I've never seen the movie at this point, right? So I'm just taking it on the face value that it's presenting to me. And I think it's one of those situations where, like, he knows that he's innocent, and we don't know how he knows that he's innocent, but it's what fed into the narrative that I believed that he had done nothing wrong. Was that moment where he's like, "Don't you read the papers? I'm innocent." And then like the laugh off joke is, "Yeah, so's everybody in here. Ha ha ha. Good night." But then there's like a hold on Adam Sandler, like kind of like looking sad about it. And I'm like,
I mean, it definitely, yeah,
the movie lies to you.
It doesn't tell you.
That's wrong. It doesn't tell you.
It lies by omission.
Yeah.
Yeah. It very much lies by omission up until it finally admits what's going on. And it's purposeful. Like you said, they do it on purpose so that they can have that moment at the end. But it does. Yeah, it's just it's really interesting that there is not this big like reveal of what a good person he truly is, and you know, not that the original one had that, right? You pointed out,
I guess for me, just when you're like, is that from the movie or is that something I put in there? They take that extra step for you to maybe question, is this guy actually innocent? Where when given the moment, Burt Reynolds is just like, it was for the money, like just. Let's not talk about it. I'll tell you, I did it, and I did it because I wanted the money. Next. Which also, then talking about like things that are changed. In the original movie, if no one has seen the original movie, spoilers for the original movie, Unger is still there. And Unger, first of all, the fact that he's paid by David Patrick Kelly. So
in the
2005 film, the modern one. I mean, that's Sully from Commando. So remember when I said I'd kill you last? I lied. That's just awesome. Like, it's just, that's all I see. And I just watched Commando, and then I'm like, oh my God, it's freaking Sully. So, like, that was awesome. But his character in the 1974 film has this weird arc where, like, it makes sense that he is snitching on crew and Caretaker and all of them, because all he wants is to be part of their little gang, and they don't want him there.
Yeah, in the original.
In the original film.
Yeah.
This movie, Paul Crewe is nothing but cordial to him. Like, it comes down to this thing where I'm just like, I don't know how this guy broke. I don't know why he's suddenly on, like, the side of the guards.
Yeah, and I'll be honest. I think that's part of where the unearnedness of that moment comes from for me, is not only is it unearned in that, like, the tone of the film seems really weirdly, like thrown up in the air at that moment, but also, like, this one character. Like, I had kind of hoped what would happen is that he was asked to do something to him and he would go to Paul and tell him, right? Like, but no.
Yeah, it's...
He goes through with it, yeah. And I mean, like, if the movie had led up to that point that there are some prisoners, you know, like, these are prisoners in a prison that has a max security wing. Like, these are not good people. These are bad. He is called out as a pyro more than once. So, like, obviously there are other issues at play, right? And this kind of speaks to some of the larger stuff going on in the ways in which this movie is very happy to shine a light on the issues with the American prison system, but at the same time is not going to offer
any solutions.
And this is something we've talked about all the before with Sandler movies in general, is that they're very happy. I mean, Chuck and Larry, actually, as we just pointed out before, right? Very happy to point to the system and say this system is fucked up, and very happy to have their guys weasel their way out of the system in some way, or get around the system, or use the system to their advantage, but never is there ever a point at which they want to actually, like, put their foot down and be like, here's what needs to happen next. And that's hard to do in an hour and a half comedy. Like, I'm not saying that they are responsible for doing it, but when you start making a pattern out of doing this where we're just going to use this shit to just make fun comedy, after a while, people start to feel like you're just... you know, using everything around you. You're taking advantage of this shit in order to make jokes, right? It becomes exploitive. And that's where I think a lot of people really start to get rubbed the wrong way with not a lot of people, but I think that some of the people that get rubbed the wrong way by Sandler comedies, that is part of it for them, is it feels like he's doing a lot of the time is exploiting this stuff in order to make funny movies. And it's interesting to me that The Longest Yard is the one movie that, like, I don't feel like I hear that a lot about with, whereas I feel like it's one of the most egregious, the ways in which it exploits the real problems that this country has with its prison systems, you know?
And I think one of the ways it skirts that is by being so faithful to the original. I think that those people saw the original movie, or if you see this one and then you see the original movie, you're like...
That's not it skirting the issue, though. That's it just getting away. The reason it gets away.
That's why it gets... Yeah, it's not skirting the issue. It still brings them up. But the reason we're not like, well, he brought it up, but then where's the solution? It doesn't... But it unfortunately, it doesn't start any discussion like that, because you're like, it's just like the original movie, right? Like they didn't do anything either. And that movie is far more vicious with, like... The 10 minutes that are cut out of that film, because that's 2 hours and a minute long, this is an hour and 50, is mostly them working on chain gangs as, like, labor, and honestly, doing nothing. It is busy work for them. They empty the swamp, and then they fill the swamp.
Yeah, I mean, I would point to the fact that this was a comedy made in the 70s, not really a time where Hollywood was... held accountable or expected to behave in a certain way. Not that it makes it any better.
No, it doesn't. I'm not saying it makes
it. It's that idea being that, like, they have this opportunity in the 2005 one to do something different, and they still don't.
Right, but I think then where the conversation gets stymied, where it doesn't continue, is people are like, yeah, but they were being so faithful to the original. There's no room for it in a faithful remake of the original. And we're just like, that's not a great argument, but argument you got. I don't want to excuse it, but I think that that's sort of how it boils out, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So then the last thing, right. So having Unger in the original actually say, can I be the team manager? And Burt Reynolds shutting him down, being like, we got Caretaker. And then, like, it makes sense. Like, that's his villain origin story. But then the way that he does it, he actually injects nitroglycerin into that light bulb. And the way that the new movie plays with that expectation of, like, oh my God, Chris Rock's going to turn on the light and he's going to get blown the fuck up.
Yeah.
So then he does it. That's the other reason why it hits you so hard. Because if you're familiar with the original film, you know that as soon as Caretaker from the original movie turns on that light bulb, he's done. So Chris Rock does it, and he survives. So if you're somebody who has that original movie, you're like, oh, he's good. He like, Unger didn't go through with it, right? Or like, he interrupted him. Like, the film's gonna make it good. And then he touches the radio, and the radio explodes, and I'm just like,
the music cue turns, and he turns towards the radio, and you're just like, no, in slow motion. Yeah,
it does this really good, and like, they play with it too. Having watched from the way I did it was I watched the Adam Sandler one, I watched the original, and then I watched the Adam Sandler one again. There's close-ups on the light bulb where, like, they are playing with the expectations of, like, probably 50% of the audience who are going to see The Longest Yard in May 2005.
Yeah.
My parents, who are like, I remember that movie. Mm-hmm. Let's go see the remake with Adam Sandler.
Well, and again, like, potentially The Longest Yard, you know, a Burt Reynolds sports comedy, there's a good chance that you could have seen this movie quite recently on, you know, like on TV or something. Or hell, gotten a weird whim and rented it, you know, in the last couple of years. Like, it's not like Longest Yard is like this like lost piece of media that nobody had, right?
It's
like,
not Semi-Tough. It's not Sharky's Machine. Like, right. Those are two, when I think of like lost Burt Reynolds movie, jump to mind. Yeah. This is, like, The Longest Yard was something, like, my father showed me The Longest Yard, which is why it's so weird that they're like, how have you never seen the Adam Sandler one? And I'm like, well, that's a good question.
The Burt Reynolds Longest Yard is one of those ones that gets lost in my head and gets mixed up a lot with Slapshot, with the Paul Newman one.
That makes sense. I get that.
Yeah, so I always kind of, like, insert Paul Newman into Longest Yard and Burt Reynolds into Slapshot.
Well, I gotta tell you, there is a scene in Slapshot where Paul Newman wears a Burt Reynolds outfit and is just fantastic. I mean, it was just the way that people were dressing in the 70s.
Yes.
But it very much looks like Paul Newman is trying to be Burt Reynolds in that moment. So as a hockey player, I kind of want to slap you. I want to hip check you for that. But as somebody who understands what sports comedies were in the 70s and the very interchangeable nature of them, you're aces, kid. I get it. All right. So what was your borrowed?
My other borrowed that I had listed is, this is just, it's just a weird thing I found as I was researching, is there's a ton of people in this movie that also were in Malcolm X.
Why would Stone Cold Steve Austin want to read about Malcolm X with his with his glasses?
So that whole fucking moment, that moment where the book, that, like, I wouldn't really have thought much of it. Actors act, and there's a big cast here. There's a huge cast in Malcolm X, so I wouldn't have thought much about it. Except this movie very specifically calls out the man Malcolm X and the book Malcolm X. So, like, as I'm going through and just trying to see where everybody is in, like, their careers and stuff, just trying to get, like, John Turturro, oh my god, Nick Turturro plays a cop in Malcolm X. William Fichtner has an uncredited role as another cop somewhere in it, but has that listed on his IMDb. And we were just talking about David Patrick Kelly.
Yeah.
David Patrick Kelly is also in Malcolm X. So there's all these weird connections to Malcolm X. And in the middle of the movie, they straight up call it out in a scene with who we have not talked about yet, Nelly.
We also haven't talked about William Fichtner. That's going to be after this. I just wanted to get out the whole, this is more of a revival than a remake. It's weirdly faithful. Like, it's faithful to the fact that I feel like Adam Sandler was like, I kind of just want to remake The Longest Yard. Oh, that'll be funny, right? Like, the guy will fart, and he'll be like, no, he's not going to fart. Like, we're just going to do The Longest Yard. Can a guy at least shit his pants? Yeah, but no Foley work. He can shit his pants. Everybody can talk about how he shit his pants, but I don't want the noise. And I'm not doing gibberish. I want to be Burt Reynolds. I wish he had the Burt Reynolds mustache. I
even when they were doing the scenes of him and Cloris Leachman, like,
another bring back too, which,
yeah,
from Spanglish, which I hate, but we were talking about Spanglish exactly a year ago, so.
But the but that whole scene, like, even in that, I kind of half expected one of the shots to be like him with a guitar on or a ukulele or something. No, not even in there. Like, nothing. The ways in which he avoids being as Adam Sandler as possible while still trying to make an Adam Sandler film is really interesting to watch.
Can we also talk about how casting Cloris Leachman in a part that was originated by Bernadette Peters is genius? Like now that her name has been said, RIP Cloris Leachman, big fans. Siegen, I know I'm a big fan. I don't want to speak for Siegen, but I'm fairly certain Say Report Incorporated. We're big fans of Clarice Leachman.
One of the funniest women to ever exist. She was hilarious.
She was always willing to be part of the joke and go further than the line. She fantastic. And for her to be the warden secretary, I'm just like, oh, Clarice Leachman. And then to go back and I'm like, Bernadette Peters played this role? And then to think that, like, there's a chance that Clarice Leachman tried to get this role, isn't there?
Like, and didn't get it in
and
the 70s.
Didn't get it in the 70s and now has it now because she played Adam Sandler's mother-in-law in Spanglish.
Man, that moment when they're showing the, you know, what goes on in the warden's office and she, like, she fucking whiffs it on the back of that couch and then, like, the next scene, the couch is still tipped over and they're still going at it. It's just really...
When she whiffs it on that couch, it's just like, oh, my God, don't die, Clarice Leachman. But she's fine. She's okay. But, like, it's also funny because he does finger guns. Like, the whole... It is a beautiful moment of visual storytelling.
Yeah.
All of that. Her hitting him with the cowboy hat on the ass is good. Is good stuff. Is really good stuff.
But that is one of those clear moments where you can watch Adam Sandler in this movie truly enjoying working on this film.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like the moments, because there's no dialogue, there's no sound. So there would be no reason for them to be, quote unquote, in character, right? Like it wouldn't be worth it to get those shots. Instead, it's just Adam Sandler and Clarice Leachman just fucking around on set together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, fully knowing. Like, all right, we have 15 so, like, minutes in this room to do whatever we want.
Exactly. The like, joy on both of their faces and the fun that they are having in that moment is so... Because I fully believe that in those moments, because they let him just have that fun, that Paul Crewe as a character... actually get kind of a joy, like, you know, like he had a good time playing around with this woman that clearly is a fan of his.
You also have to think about the fact that in the original movie Burt Reynolds has sex with Bernadette Peters to get the game tape. And the big thing is that, like, can you get me a woman? Like, you're in prison, it's all men. And I feel like I have just introduced so many segue points into our blue, which I'm just gonna rapid fire mine. Is the sailor suit that Courtney Cox tries to get him to wear in the beginning?
I mean, like,
it's
if there was
so
anything
blue.
Oh my God. But if there's anything to show how much she does not, like, we only get to see them together for like a minute, like you said, right? And in that minute, we get so much about their relationship that we understand entirely where Paul Crewe is in their relationship and where he is kind of in the world. The fact that he is literally a dancing monkey.
He's a kept man, and it's... Ooh. I'll credit, though, to him for the line of, like, oh, yeah, let me just finish the game, then I'll take you to the movies. The movies? What are you talking about? Oh, God, it is.
Yeah.
But then she's like, you can put on your little suit. And I'm just like, that looks like Donald Duck cosplay, which also fed into the whole bedtime stories of it all.
Oh, man.
It was just, yeah, but that's my blue. I couldn't pick of anything else bluer than that sailor suit.
No. Yeah, that's true. I couldn't stop focusing on the casual homophobia. I mean, it has to be the
thing. Is it 2005?
Right?
What?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, it's bred into the whole story because it is a prison story, right? Like, it's one of those things where the second that you know you're going into a 2005 comedy that has to take place in a prison, like, I knew it was coming, and I'll be honest, it was not nearly as present or biting as I kind of thought it was going to be. You know, I will point to the biggest offenders of this probably having to be the cheerleading squad led by Tracy Morgan, right? Like that.
Which we haven't mentioned Tracy Morgan. There's so many people in this movie.
Tracy Morgan looking fucking good in this movie too, by the way. I don't know what point in this is compared to when he like starts out. Like he's. Famously, Tracy Morgan has some issues in his life, right? Like, we are all aware that that a lot of the stuff that Tracy Jordan is doing in 30 Rock is direct shit that they had to deal with Tracy Morgan kind of doing, as well as a couple of other people. There's some Eddie Murphy stuff thrown in there, some Richard Pryor stuff thrown in as well. But, like, the ways in which he acts in that show in 30 Rock are not too far off from the way that he kind of behaved on the set of SNL, famously. And so...
I was seeing him in this movie and I was thinking, man, this is like, this is him coming off of SNL and trying to find what he's going to be doing next and trying to figure out what that's going to be. And so there's this weird element of just like, are they going to let him just go full Tracy Morgan? And they never do in this movie. Like, they, like, as I was saying, like this role that he plays in these characters of the cheerleading squad are actually used rather sweetly in a lot of scenes. Like, they, like, there's definitely some moments between Nick Turturro and specifically Tracy Morgan's character. What's his character's name?
Which one, Tracy Morgan or Brucey?
Tracy Morgan.
I don't know if Tracy Morgan's ever given a character name. To be completely honest with you, I don't.
Yeah. I mean, which kind of probably leads to the to the ways in which they were treated in the film, right? Like, there's a weird level in which there is an acceptance to who that particular crew is, and there is a ways in which they are referred to that are sometimes respectful, which was more than I expected, but it's not all the time. It's just not. And the jokes that are there and the bits that are there about like the let's all shower together and stuff like that. And the blatant fear, like the idea that like male to male anal sex could be a punishment in general is like one of the biggest things that like it's always used as like a fear response moment for guys, right? Like, and you see it when Paul first goes to meet the warden, and the warden's, how do you refer to him?
He's my public relations manager, Errol Dandridge. I don't know why the name Errol Dandridge was in my head, but I got it. It said the one time. And it's you know who that guy is, right?
He's only been in like four movies, and the only other movie he's been in is Mr. Deeds.
He's the opera singer in Mr. Deeds. Genius. And I'm just like,
Walter Williamson is who we're talking about.
Yeah. And they call him Colonel Sanders, a la The Waterboy, bringing back a Colonel Sanders reference. It is just, and I'm just, I didn't know who he was the whole movie. I thought, like, this is someone acting their ass off. And then I'm like, oh, no, it's the guy who was in Mr. Deeds, also acting his ass off. But I thought that there was, like, someone known.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, I mean, it's just great. This guy.
Maybe he had a really good stage career. I like to think that he had a really good stage career, probably playing a lot of Orson Welles roles in his late life.
Oh, my God. I can't wait to the Say Report. I'm sorry when you bring up the OW's name. I got thoughts about him this week, but it's good stuff. But
Walter Williamson is who we're talking about, and in that moment when he walks in and there's jokes about that character and that character, like every joke with that character is how effeminate they are, right? So there's just throughout there's this casual homophobia. Is it as bad as I expected it to be when I first kind of went into this thing? No, but it's there, and we'd be remiss to not call it out.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that's sort of what I thought it was going to be, just because there is a lack of women in this movie, just by the very nature of the setting. So, I mean, Courtney Cox is kind of put on full display, as is every other woman at that party. But the weird thing about, and it doesn't excuse it, it certainly doesn't excuse it.
I mean, if you want to talk about, like, male gays in this movie, the most egregious moment of it is when they get to the game.
Oh, yeah,
and
the cheerleaders.
Like, doing, like, the montage of the hype-up at the game. No, it's not the cheerleaders. It's when they're showing the crowd coming in. They show
all these guys walk through, pause on the woman's breasts.
And then there's this weird pause on just a torso of a woman, and they're the only person that gets stopped by security, the only person that has a bar run over them, and it just sits there and stares at this woman's torso for, like, 2 seconds. And it's 2 seconds too long, thank you. It's really weird.
Luckily I was able to flush it out of my mind because it wasn't that long, but yeah, that's a moment. And then them leering at the cheerleaders, but also they've been in prison with just men for a very long time. Some of them are on death row, like Turley. We haven't talked about the great Kali, and I can't remember his actual name, and I feel bad about that. Dalip? It was him. Like, he's apparently been given the chair
Dalip Singh.
He's apparently been given the chair 3 times and it just never took. Like, that's the joke about the character. He should have earnest powers, as far as I'm concerned.
Or at least be let out of prison. As far as I am aware, you know, and maybe this is just movie law, but I was under the impression that if they try to put you to death and it doesn't work, that's a pretty quick review of whether or not we're going to get you out of the system or not, because they don't...
3 strikes, you should be out of that prison. Let's just be honest. I don't know. It's ridiculous. But, like, you don't think about that. You don't think about the fact that that guy did something to be on death row in Texas.
Like, he could just be that he was not white, to be fair. But true. We're not gonna get that deep down the political rabbit hole. But I will say, like, the moment that you call out, right, where they come out of the tunnel and the cheerleaders are there, they make comments to the cheerleaders, like, hey, hi, like, how you doing, that kind of thing. But the second those cheerleaders are like, no, and they're told to leave them alone, they walk away.
They walk away.
Like,
that's fair.
Like, there's no that's not really that gross of a moment to me, because, like, these guys who, as you have pointed out, have been having conversations about looking for women.
Yeah.
There are women there. They introduce themselves. They are told to leave those women alone, and they do. That's the entire moment.
That could, like, be the power of 12 high-powered sniper rifles.
Yes, yes. Like, there is definitely something to be said about the ways in which that scene is framed by, like, the cops being the ones to, like, push them along and stuff, for sure. But end of the day, we're not given any evidence by them that they would mistreat women in any way.
That's true.
Like,
that's,
we're not told any of them are that kind of person, right? And so we can't just assume that about them.
Yeah, they do a really good job to make sure that it's just thieves and murderers.
Yeah. They never say anything about, like, rape or, like, assault or anything like that. Sexual assault specifically.
Yeah.
That's just not in the story anywhere, right? Whereas baked into it pretty hard is a lot of the stuff about, like, male, like, love and just the complete denial of it, you know?
Yeah. And using it as a springboard, I really did feel like that was something that was reflective of the time that it was made in. But then when they're at the game, the Cell Block C Cheerios, like, that is something that's weirdly present in the original Longest Yard. Crazily, to actually give them, like, character development and moments outside of being a bunch of cross-dressing men at the football game feels like it's sort of progressive.
Well, I think the 2005 of it all is that they are actually labeled transvestites in the credits, which, as we have talked about recently on this show with Mixed Nuts, oddly, the movie that seems to just keep rearing its ugly head, as we've talked about, is, like, a term that we just don't use anymore, right?
Right.
So, like, I think it's not – I think there is definitely a move in the ways that these characters are treated in this movie to not be so mean, but it cannot escape some of its other bullshit. It just can't.
Yeah, that's true. But talking about other bullshit, because that is just insane to me, the things that are in this movie that felt like, oh, that could have been an Adam Sandler bit, but it is just whole-handed, lifted and transplanted from the Burt Reynolds film, is him making fun of the short cop. Like, I'm just like, really? Like, that seemed like Adam Sandler just kind of riffing on this guy.
Especially with Dan Patrick standing there and, like, giving him high fives while he's doing it. It feels like a very Adam Sandler moment, for sure. Yeah.
And then to see, like,
in another moment, though, where he could be as drunk Adam Sandler, he very often takes that as a cue to put on funny voice, and that we don't see that happen there either.
Yeah, no, he is completely in control in that moment. He doesn't do, hey,
ass,
lucky
child.
Yes. Yeah, but I mean, he's still Paul Crewe.
Yeah.
And
I think on a darker note, like, I think there's also an element to it where I think he is trying to kill himself. Like, that moment when he gets into that car accident in the first, like, 5 minutes of this movie, I fully, wholeheartedly believe that he does not expect or does not care, I'll put it that way, if he comes out of that one alive.
Oh, yeah. I'm right there with you.
I think you're supposed to believe that's how far down he is that he is pretty much in a position where he doesn't care if he makes it out of that car chase.
And that's the inherent difference between Adam Sandler's Paul Crewe and Burt Reynolds' Paul Crewe. Burt Reynolds' Paul Crewe feels like he is still untouchable. He can just do whatever he wants. He does not feel suicidal in that beginning moment, which is a great chase, a great Burt Reynolds chase at the beginning of The Longest Yard. If you've seen the Adam Sandler Longest Yard, you don't need to go back and watch the full Burt Reynolds Longest Yard. Like I said, it's pretty faithful, but you should watch that car chase in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, they knew how to do car chases.
Oh, my God.
When
he goes halfway over the bridge, the suspension bridge, the one that opens up. I don't know what those are called. Drawbridge?
Yeah, but when he goes over the open bridge, yeah.
He doesn't go over an open bridge, though. He goes over a bridge, and then when he sees that a boat is coming, he turns around so that the cops get stuck on the bridge as it's raising. And I'm just like, what a cool way to do that. Like, I expected him fully to do the Blues Brothers jump of it all. But no, he just, it's a good car chase. It's something they knew how to do in the 70s. It's certainly something you had come to expect from a Burt Reynolds film. I was not expecting a fucking amazing car chase to lead off the 1974 Longest Yard.
It's so much what you expect from a Burt Reynolds film that they make fun of it in Archer when he is on for a couple of episodes as his mother's love interest.
Yeah.
They do the entire scene, the entire car chase bit there. And he's like, I'm goddamn Burt Reynolds. Let me drive.
I mean, there's also the lampshade hangover. He's like, there's a car chase in the Longest Yard. they talk about it. Like, it's one of those things where it's just like, yeah, that's true. But I do, you know, to have both Paul Crews driving around a Saturday Night Special by Leonard Skinner and, like, really cool. Is it Leonard Skinner or is it Led Zeppelin? I don't know. I'm an idiot right now. I feel like a damn fool.
Saturday Night Special?
Yeah.
when you said that it was
I think it's Skinner. I'm pretty sure it's Skinner, but it could be the other one, or it could be all those bands sort of blend together
it's
to me.
Skinner?
Yeah, is it Skinner? Oh, okay, thank God.
Yeah. Me worried for a second there. I was like, is it not?
Like that song, they're a nothing band in the Longest Yard, right? Like it's just a song that like let's put it in the movie. It sounds good. But they're a struggling band. They haven't made it yet. And then for it to be used in that moment in the 2005 one, it's like, now they're Leonard fucking Skinner. Now everybody knows that. It's cool, but it's also really nice that, like, that's a moment that's, like, sort of lifted from then to now. But, yeah, he definitely seems like he's probably suicidal. I mean, you don't stop in the middle of a four-way intersection if you expect to walk out of it.
No, I mean, in the way that those cars, the cop cars hit him, I mean, he is lucky to be alive. Like, it's a crazy car chase scene. And I think what they're doing is they're really setting up in the first bits of this movie, like, how much of a remake this really is going to be. Like, to the point where they're using the same music beats and all that, you know?
Yeah.
They just really want to make the
They are setting your expectations, and then they do a great job with it. I also love when he's yelling up at the helicopter that he's breaking up with Lena.
Yes, that's a good moment.
It's just a great like moment, and it's a cool way to modernize it. And then of course it's not going to be Florida. Like why is the first movie set in Florida? Texas in 2005. We know at this point that football is a religion there, so of course. There's like guard leagues of football.
Well, right.
Teams.
And
like,
so the idea that football is such a thing that inmates could be playing like away games from their prison is like, that's the most Texas I've ever Texas. Like,
I think you have to say Texas one more time just to really jam it home.
No, yeah. I'm afraid if I do, it'll show up at my door. So I'm not going to do that.
Is it four times with Texas? Oh, the yellow rose of Texas. It's just nuts. Like, that's really the fact, the biggest thing modernization wise is the fact that warden has aspirations to be governor of Texas.
That warden, by the way, we have not really.
Oh, yeah, James Cromwell, right? Fuck me.
The big villain in this movie. but yeah, the idea that the warden, that James Cromwell's character has this, like, aspiration of going from running this prison to being governor, and the way that he's going to really get there is by being good at football. It all makes sense on a very, like, funny, like, low, like, shallow. That's what I'm looking for, shallow scale, right? Like, I'm not going to sit here and shit on Texas for the rest of the episode.
No, that'd be foolish.
But there is definitely an element of calling bullshit out here of, like, yeah, we're going to put it in Texas, and it's going to be football, and this guy's going to have this whole, like, aspiration. It all feeds a kind of an understanding of what we all kind of were thinking at that time of Texas. And
I mean,
football.
The worst thing about it is, I mean, and this is me. This is totally me, like, adding on top of that. But you know why you want to become governor of Texas, right, Sejan?
to play more football? No, why?
To become president of the United States.
Oh, yes, yeah, right.
Like, yeah, that was... Of course. The last two presidents, and both of them happened to be named Bush, but the last two Republican presidents had formerly been governors of Texas.
Right.
So, like, it is this whole, like, third level where you talk about, like, just the disparity between law and criminals, of the fact that, like, this guy saying that he wants to be governor, he might as well be saying, I'd like to be president of the United States one day. And it just hit me, like, that whole thing. And that is just something that's not there in the original movie. And that is, that's the thing that I'm talking about. And that's why I think this film would be difficult to remake in the way that they remade it in 2005. Because I think that, like,
they'd have to definitely do some updating and some refiguring to make it fit in a post-2020. Not least of which, because I think that the prison aspect of it would have to become a huge focus, right? Like the idea of this being a prison. First of all, it would probably be a private prison, right? It wouldn't be a state prison in any way.
Right.
He'd end up at some privately owned one. Then there would be that whole commentary going on.
And then Jeremy Renner's the warden. No.
All of these, Jeremy Renner's a weird pull, but I'm interested.
Well, for mayor of Kingstown, he's the warden of those three prisons. Well, he's the mayor of Kingstown, where there are three prisons. Jim Caviezel is another one who I'd like to see as a warden. That's based on Escape Plan. Continue. I'm sorry.
I mean, apparently Gary Oldman was up for the warden role in this movie. And that would have been. It wasn't able to swing it, so they got Cromwell. But imagine getting Gary Oldman to play.
I'm happy they got Cromwell. I love James Cromwell.
I love a bad James Cromwell. Oh, I like give me Babe any day of the week, sure. But man, L.A. Confidential James Cromwell is one of my top 10 movie villains of all time is him in that movie.
That's excellent. That is a great pull.
The final shootout at the motel is seared in my brain. Nice. Like, I love that movie.
Yeah. And as soon as I'm like, he's the bad guy, that's awesome. For Longest Yard.
Sorry, spoiler alert for LA Confidential. It is a bit of a twist, but I mean, that movie is about corruption in LA and the cops. If you didn't know that the big bad was going to turn out to be the fucking head of the police, you weren't paying attention.
Speaking of the warden, we have to talk about just brief, and then we got to probably get to Passing Judgment, though I have thoughts on Passing Judgment on this particular film right now. Ed Lautner. We have to talk about Ed Lautner, who plays the warden in the original film and then plays Dwayne in the remake. And the fact that, first of all, I loved the number of articles that I found who talked about the fact that he shows up as the warden and as Dwayne in The Longest Yard. And I'm like, you guys just looked at IMDb for this. Because Dwayne is nobody. Dwayne is a named cameo, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. He gets one line, and he's just like, I think you slept with my wife. I love it.
Yeah. And it's like, and he wasn't in the script. Like, all they really got from that first movie is Burt Reynolds, which is crazy because of another pull that they could have had. Which I'll talk about briefly. But Ed Lautner was apparently visiting set, and they're like, hey, do you want to be in the movie? You should probably be in the movie. And they write up a scene for him, and he's friends with the warden, and that's also fantastic. Yeah. But then I'm a little disappointed. Like, Richard Kiel, who was Happy's boss in Happy Gilmore, he's in the first Longest Yard as the big, scary guy who becomes Sikowski in the remake. Yeah. It would have been great if he showed up somewhere. Like,
isn't he Jaws? Am I
he is Jaws, right? Yes.
Yeah.
And then Dilip Singh goes on to sort of play Jaws.
I mean, Dilip Singh is it just, looking at him, I was like, I think that dude is just Jaws in real life.
But yeah, isn't he in Get Smart, which would totally make sense because it's Peter Siegel again. But yeah.
Yeah, it is Get Smart. But the other one that he's in, the big one that made me kind of jump for joy when I realized it, was he's the big guy in MacGruber too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which also checks out with everything that we know about this film. But yeah, it was one of those situations where I'm just like, oh my God, imagine if Richard Kiel had showed up in The Longest Yard 2?
Yeah.
Not The Longest Yard 2. That's a different movie that never exists. Thank goodness.
It exists in Devin's head.
No, don't. I'm going to dream of it tonight. But yeah, it's just, this is a really, like, I can't believe that of the Adam Sandler films that I missed, the 10 Adam Sandler films that I missed, and if you're following along at home, we've covered about 4 of them so far. So, like, keep your cards warm. It'll be a good time. That, like, it's so good. Like, I thought that, like, this is not a movie I hear people talk about, but whenever I brought it up, like, people lit up. People were, like, excited to talk about The Longest Yard, and I wasn't expecting that. But it tracks when you consider it's the second most, like, highest profited sports comedy after The Waterboy. Like, that's, like, freaking Adam Sandler. What are you doing? That's incredible, buddy. Buddy. Yeah. I don't know what the fuck that was.
It's them football comedies, though.
Yeah.
It is
Adam Sandler understanding what the audience wants. And then for this film to increase that range by bringing in professional wrestling fans, by bringing in, like, music fans in terms of, like, Nelly. We never talked about Nelly as Dave Meggett, which is, he's fantastic.
Yeah, and that whole moment in the library with the Malcolm X book and him being goaded, and he doesn't go for it, which is an awesome moment. It's fantastic. Yeah.
And then like actual NFL players too. So it's not like it's just professional football. You have guys who played in the league, like Brian the Boz Bosworth as a guard, because he wasn't hyper highly regarded while he was in the league. He was kind of, after 3 years, he was kind of a draft disaster, I believe is what they call that. But then, like, it's a good flick. It's a good flick top down. I mean, Chris Berman. I love Chris Berman. And when he's the announcer you get in your movie, like, you've already won my heart. And they had one of my heart.
He's the one that has all those moments
with Babyface Bob.
With Babyface Bob, right?
Really.
That was really fun.
Woo!
How'd you do that sound? I like that sound.
It's good to see you smiling, Bob. It's about a give and take, Seijin. So, okay. So now is the time. Now is the time where we would usually pass judgment on whether or not this film is part of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Usually.
I'd like to put it on pause. And I'm sorry to the audience. I'm sorry to Seijin. I did not talk about him with this. I'd like to put it on pause because right now I'm of two minds. And I think I need a little bit more data before I fully pass judgment on The Longest Yard.
Okay. I will say that I'm kind of in a somewhat similar place. I mean, I'm ready to call it one way or the other, but I'm not sure I'm ready to call it one way or the other. Like, if you were to tell me that you strongly believed this movie was in, I totally could get on board with that. If you told me you strongly believed it was not in, I could definitely get on board with that too. It has this element to it where it feels like it's just a good old Adam Sandler time. Does that justify it being in the quote-unquote universe that we've kind of been exploring? I don't think that's enough. But I think what it is that there's not enough there to discount it either, right? Like, there's not enough going on to make it feel like it's not in it. You know, I will say that we do have a pretty, well, I guess we decided tenuous connection with Rob Schneider, right? Like, in playing this character.
If he were called Townie... I don't think this was something I was wrestling with going into the recording. You're like, where you thought I was reticent to record the Chris Rock portion of our opening scene. It was more the fact that I'm like, I need to be receptive. I need to be on the lookout for anything that CJ might have done. But at the end of the day, I think I'm holding us passing judgment on this one. And there's one reason why I'm holding us passing judgment on this one. And that's because of the movie that we're watching next month. Do you remember what the movie for next month is, Seijin?
No, I have no clue.
That's fine. So it is season 5. It's remakes, it's reboots, it's redos. And for March, we're going to be watching Anger Management. Not a remake of itself, but it was then remade as a 100-episode television show starring Charlie Sheen. So after looking at two films that were remade from films, you know, with Mr. Deeds and The Longest Yard, we're going to watch a film that was then remade itself into something else. And we're going to explore that a little bit. It's going to be kind of a weird episode. But
I mean, like, yeah, I mean, Mr. Deeds, we kind of looked at because it was remade, but Sandler basically just took a basic premise and then put a bunch of Adam Sandler stuff around it. Longest Yard we looked at because this really does feel like it is just Adam Sandler in The Longest Yard, right? Like,
yeah.
It does, it, like, as we it feels about, like it's such a faithful reaction.
You know, Nathan Lane is no longer playing Max Bialystock. It will now be played by Adam Sandler. Oh my God, I would love that. Actually, I'd like Kevin James as Bialystock. You put Adam Sandler in the Bloom role.
Fuck that, man. Do this right. Adam Sandler and Alan Covert as the producer.
Speaking of which, Covert, right? Not as covert, because he gets
not
hit
too
in,
covert.
He gets hit in the nuts twice, but
oh man. Always plays a good asshole though. Always when you need somebody to come in and just be a jerk to the main character for a little bit, you can always depend on Alan Covert.
If you need a referee also, if Dana Carvey's not available, I think you ask Alan Covert. But the real reason why I'd like to hold off passing judgment on this one is because Anger Management is the third film, and actually the first film, in the three films that Adam Sandler made with Peter Siegel. And so far, we've covered the first one, which was 50 First Dates, and we came down on that didn't fit into the universe.
Yeah, it had a weird feel to it, like it was like a universe next door.
Yeah, like it's very similar. There's a lot of similar things. If I look at it the right way, maybe, but it still feels like a little bit removed. And that is exactly how I feel about The Longest Yard. There are themes that we can talk about. I could do a whole theory about the fact that Paul does die in that car crash. And being in Allenville Federal Penitentiary is actually him being in hell. I don't want to explore that theory because it's just a cockamamie thing I literally came up with.
Well,
but
we have the beauty of Little Nicky, in which we see actual hell. And I'll be honest, Allenville seems like it's even worse than that.
Yeah, exactly. So it's there's thoughts and there's things. It could easily go both ways for me. This could be part of the universe. This could not be part of the universe. But because of the fact that the first Peter Siegel one we looked at, we kind of fell on the same decision where it could go either way.
Yeah.
I think that the best thing to do, and if we weren't doing Anger, like we plan out the season from the beginning. We know what we're watching, which is why 4 was so fun, because we had no idea during season 4. And you guys, you threw us for a loop. Honestly, I was not prepared for Rain Over Me. That's still one that kind of surprised me when people were like, please do Rain Over Me.
I still can't believe we watched The Cobbler, but yeah.
Yeah, well, this is what the fans asked for. But like, we didn't have that planned out. We have this planned out. And like, so Anger Management, I'm like, it's sort of got this remake thing. It fits. And then we're doing the two Peter Siegels back to back. It should be fun. If we weren't doing that, I would pass judgment today. And honestly, I'm going to say it so that you don't think it's a total cock block cliffhanger moment here. I don't think I would put this in the universe based on everything that I've known and everything that I've assessed.
No, I think what we should do next month, I'm totally on board with this. I think what we need to do is next month, we come with like the hard, fast rules that we have about the universe, like ready to remind everybody, including ourselves, what they are. And we'll talk about them. We'll talk about all three. We'll revisit 50 First Dates. I don't think our opinion is going to change. I have a funny sneaking suspicion where I think I know the next two decisions are going to go. I am currently in that same place that I was with 50 First Dates. And as you seem to be with this movie too, is like there's a lot of really fun stuff. And because of how much I enjoy it, I definitely want to try and fit it in, and I could make some excuses to fit it in, but I'd have to work for it, and that's not the point, right? Like, I shouldn't have to. It should be what is present in the film should dictate whether or not it falls into this connected universe that everybody's been so excited about.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's the fact that 50 First Dates kind of fits in better than The Longest Yard, but we said no to it. Right. So how can I reconcile that? So yeah. we're going to, so that's it. So sorry to not give a definitive answer on this one. But make sure you listen next month to the anger management episode, where the whole deliberation and judgment thing is going to be longer than it probably ever has been for any of these Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Yeah, because episodes. We really got to take a look at specifically Peter Siegel and the work that he did with Sandler. Like, we got to decide if maybe this is just all its own thing.
Yeah, because I got to tell you, right now, that's sort of what the data is presenting. But I don't want to pass judgment until I have assessed every possible, like, set of data I have in front of me. So with that, sorry. If you want to let us know where you think it goes, you can get us on Twitter at the ASCU. Maybe I'll put a poll up and we can have a vote where you guys think the longest yard lands. But I'm very interested in what you have to say. But it's going to be next month when we do anger management as part of the remakes, redos, revisits, where we will finally determine whether or not the longest yard is in our Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, no matter what, if you do that poll, no matter what you guys vote on there, that's not going to affect our decision.
Yeah, no, that's just, we want to, you were so great being the fans, telling us what you wanted us to review last season, that it would be very nice to see where you guys think, where your minds are at. But it's our definitive universe. So that vote is your view on it. I don't freaking know.
No, it'll definitely be something for us to talk about. But I will say right here, right now, that if we decide it's not in it, and you guys are all like, "Oh, but I like it," that we'll still say it's not in it. Or vice versa. Yeah.
Or vice versa. Yeah. If everybody's like, "No, you're right. This why are you guys wasting our time here?" And then we'd do the work. It's like, oh, it fits. What it's who knows? Everything is in flux right now. We are Schrodinger's ASCU until next month when we do anger management. So make sure you manage your anger. So this has been the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm Devin Decker. He's Sejan Sarawick. We do another podcast. That one is weekly, as this is only monthly, called The Say Report. That's the show about everything, where we talk literally about everything. So if you like just talking about one specific topic, namely Adam Sandler and his filmography, you might enjoy us just kind of going scattershot on whatever floats our boat that week. And I know for a fact that there's going to be talk about The Superb Owl, The Big Game, and probably all the stuff that happened with Nintendo Switch Online earlier today during the Nintendo Direct. So it should be a fun episode. If you've never checked that one out, if you've only listened to us at the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, make sure you check us out on The Say Report, wherever podcasts are found. And if you have anything specifically to send to Sejan, make sure that you get him. You mentioned that it's for Sejan when you tweet us at the Say Report or at the ASCU on Twitter. Because he's not on there anymore.
No, but Devin is. You can find him at Devin D. Decker.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear from you. Specifically about The Longest Yard. I do think that it's kind of tragic in a lot of ways. And it's not what this show is about. This show is not to be a downer. We're going to try to be positive about it. I really liked the film. It's probably going to be one of those ones I throw on in the background. It's what is that fact that you found from Netflix that just like kind of blew my mind?
Oh, of the, you know, so Netflix, the like ratings on Netflix, the way that it's worded, it explains that this is the number one of the most liked films in the top 10, one of the most liked films by people who have watched it. So the number is based on both that they watched the entirety of the movie and they said they liked it. And anybody that watched this movie, they liked it.
I mean, it tracks. It's a pretty enjoyable time. And hopefully we've had a lovely discussion on that. But if we haven't, well, we'll see you next month when we venture once again into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And until that time, just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good one, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not rate or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.